The following is a recording of the Laura Werner teleconference with the American Hospital Association of Washington, scheduled for Wednesday, February 10th, 2010 at 12:30 p.m. Central Time. Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, we now have our speakers in conference. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of the presentation, we will open the floor for questions. At that time, instructions will be given if you would like to ask a question. I would now like to turn the conference over to Scott Mullaney. Mr. Mullaney, please begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. On behalf of all the team involved in trying to make this session happen, I'd like to thank you for your flexibility. I'm in Northwest Ohio right now, and actually it's 82 degrees and perfectly sunny here, but I understand it's not quite so good the rest of the country. So your flexibility is much appreciated. If I could, I'm just going to take a brief moment and go back and recap where we were from the last meeting, then turn it over to Rich Umdenstock for a few moments, then to Nancy Foster for an introduction of Dr. Fisher, and then we can begin with Dr. Fisher's talk to us. In the first session, the task force members heard a number of speakers. Those of you on the task force don't need me to tell you that, about the current research on the issue of geographic variation in healthcare spending. We talked about key factors driving variation, payment factors, clinical uncertainty, public health issues, and the like. Another speaker talked on measuring performance across geographic regions, including spending and a whole number of other dimensions. Today, we're going to get a kind of a primer on the work of the Dartmouth Institute on spending across regions and organizations and hear about their ideas for addressing variation. We'll also see data on variation in spending in the private pay population and hear a cautionary note about the potential linkage between quality and spending. To help us think about potential ways to address variation in spending, we'll hear from two organizations that have taken innovative approaches to reduce clinical variation and promote the development and dissemination of best practices. Hopefully, this is going to continue to deepen the richness of the background we have as a task force as we continue our work. Before we get to our first speaker, I'd like to turn it over to Rich for his comments. Rich?
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Scott. And I really appreciate the chance to offer a few quick comments. First of all, I want to thank everybody for their participation, for dialing in today, making this meeting happen, and keeping this dialogue on schedule. I'm sorry I missed the first meeting due to a schedule conflict, but I was glad that the process got off to a great start. There's probably no more complicated, important, or emotional issue than the one on variation. And so I really am pleased that the task force and with broader participation from people from across the field, is starting with this kind of educational approach. I know it's an area where a lot of people have very strong feelings and probably feel very personally connected to particular answers or strategies, but I think we've all been involved in work on complex subjects, and in retrospect, I think would agree that identifying the questions, educating ourselves as broadly as possible, being open to a variety of points of view, is the way to really have a rich discussion and good exchange and going forward and eventually come to the right position. So I'm really pleased that we're doing this. I'm pleased that the speakers are able to hold on to this time for us. I know this is going to continue to enrich the work of the task force going forward. Let me just offer a quick update on health reform, such as I can, at this point, because maybe on people's minds as to where things stand, and in particular, how that affects the time frame and the work of this group. The way that I would characterize what's happening in D.C. right now reminds me a lot of what clinicians call watchful waiting. I think everybody is waiting to see what happens, where the president and the congressional leaders decide to take this conversation, either together in a bipartisan fashion or on a partisan basis under Democratic leadership, if that's what happens, or maybe step back and call for some sort of timeout or just move on to other issues. Clearly, in the last couple of weeks, it's been a matter of lying low and sorting out what their political options are. We now know that the president has scheduled a meeting and invited others, other leaders in on the 25th of this month. I think we'll all have to wait and see what happens there and what comes out of that before passing judgment as to whether it is a substantive step or whether it is more of the political posturing that's gone on lately. In terms of the impact on this group, I think it just gives more time in the sense that any new reformulation of the current bills or the development of a new bill or anything like that is going to take time. So I don't think that this group needs to alter its original time frame. Obviously, the quicker we can come to consensus and vet it with the field and get some momentum behind a set of recommendations, the better. But health care reform, to state the obvious, is not imminent at this time, so I don't think there needs to be an adjustment in the calendar. So, Mr. Chairman, let me turn it back to you and again, just underscore my thanks and my desire to really be personally involved in this important undertaking and do all I can to help you all keep it moving along.
Thanks, Rich. And for those of you that don't know this, Rich really has been very involved, even though he wasn't able to make our first meeting. So we appreciate you being here today, and your guidance is much appreciated. I'm going to turn it over to Nancy, but before I do that, to all the listeners, there'll be a chance at the end of Dr. Fisher's talk to ask questions. So maybe jot down any thoughts you have. We'll have a dedicated amount of time for that, so we'll try and keep track of number of questions and length of time for the answers, but we'll definitely have a chance for that at the end. So with that in mind, Nancy?
Thank you very much, Scott, and I have to confess I'm really delighted to have this opportunity to introduce Dr. Elliot Fisher. I can't remember the first time I met Elliot, but I've known him for many years, and I've always learned from him whenever I've heard him speak, either in a large group or in a small group discussions, or even when he and I have been able to chat on the phone. He's helped me think about things differently, and I know that's what he's going to do for this task force as well. Elliot, as the recently appointed director of the Dartmouth Atlas of Healthcare, continues a tradition of research that he and Jack Wenberg and others, including John Berkmeyer, whom you'll hear from later, have been involved in for many years. Where Dartmouth is really provoking us to think differently about the health care that is delivered. The first question they began to tease out nearly three decades ago is this question of, well, is there really variation in the care that is provided? Having answered that question in the affirmative, they then proceeded with a series of research projects that really began to tease out the notion of what does the variation mean to patients and patient care? Does it result in better outcomes for them? Does it provide something more for them than otherwise they would have had? And now some of their seminal work is really beginning to help public policymakers think about the question of how do we address variation that does not equate to more benefit to the patient. So it's terrific that he's able to join the task force for important conversation about variation. Elliot is a professor of medicine and community and family medicine at the Dartmouth Medical School. He's director for population health and policy at the Health and Policy Institute for Healthcare Policy and Clinical Practice. He received his undergraduate and medical degrees from Harvard and completed his residency at the University of Washington, where he also received a master's in public health. Elliot, with that, I'd like to turn it over to you, and we all look forward to hearing what you have to say.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Nancy, Scott, Rich. It really is a treat to be here, and I want to thank all the members of the task force for digging in, you know, so seriously on what is a tough issue. It's tough in terms of how it makes us think about healthcare, and it's tough in terms of even understanding that it's some of the difficult technical issues around the methods. My hope for this afternoon is that, and I believe having looked at, you know, everybody's slides, that we'll end up in a very similar place. I think that the Dartmouth work really provides some insights that lead us to thinking about what will be required to transform our healthcare system in ways that are better for the patients that we serve. Now, let's see if I can advance my slide. So we'll, yeah, there we are. So this will be just the title slide. And I think the current paradox in healthcare is that, or the current dilemma we face is that we really perceive this as a choice between spending more and rationing care. And I think by the end of, you know, by the end of the afternoon, I hope we'll see that there's a third way, that redesign and clinical improvement strategies really will get us out of the box that we're in. So, you know, the work does go back 30 years to Jack Weinberg, who really, in Vermont, compared practice patterns, you know, surgical rates across 13 hospital small identical communities, found 10-fold differences in surgery and 2-fold differences in spending that could not be explained on the basis of differences in patient characteristics. You know, since then, moving on to what will be a slide titled Per Capita Medicare Spending, for those of you who are following along by phone and paper, you know, we've also looked at trends in geographic variations in the growth in spending rates, and they're pretty substantial. You know, we have many regions of the country where per capita spending has grown at a full percentage point underneath, below that of the U.S. average after adjusting for inflation. And we have places such as Long Island and San Francisco that started out at exactly the same point, but grew at somewhat different rates, 2.4% versus 4%. And by now that translates into an annual difference of about $1 billion a year for the residents, in excess Medicare payments for the residents of Long Island than if they had continued to receive care at the rate that is provided in San Francisco. Yeah, if everyone could grow at 2.5%, that's still growth. If everyone could still grow at 2.5%, you know, the United States would save about $1.4 trillion between now and 2023. So there are real opportunities to achieve savings from modest deflections in growth rates and, you know, doing better. So what I'm going to try to do, you know, over the next 40 minutes is address sort of four major topics. You know, what we know, some current points of confusion, you know, most of the argument over the last year or so promoted by actually the map that you're looking at that has the high and low spending regions. You know, the low spending regions think it's unfair that the high spending regions get more. They proposed that we cut spending in the high-spending regions, and not surprisingly, institutions in the high-spending regions got upset. So I think what we've managed to do is make everybody angry at the Dartmouth Atlas. But I want to walk us through what I think we've learned, address those points of confusion, and then think about how can we move, you know, what do we need to understand to move forward, what explains the differences we see, and how, what are the policy levers that we really should be thinking about jointly if we're going to get out of the dilemma that we're in right now. You know, the first set of studies we did, about, you know, six, you know, peer-reviewed studies, looked simply at the health implications of the regional variations in spending. We actually used end-of-life measures to characterize U.S. hospital referral regions. That is, we looked at how intensively regions treated patients at the end of life, which predicted very accurately how those regions treated patients with heart attacks, hip fractures, and colon cancer as we followed them forward. And I'll come back to this in a minute. But the basic notion was to look at outcomes, to look at the content and quality of care, we had to identify coherent clinical cohorts with good risk-adjusted data that we could follow forward. And we did that. And we compared the content, quality, and outcomes of care across high and low spending regions. And the differences in spending, and these are price adjusted, so these are using constant prices for physician services and hospital services, the differences are pretty substantial. The red areas there are spending about 20, in 1996, we're spending about $2,300 more per beneficiary than the pale areas. So what we think, and what I think My guess is my colleagues who are presenting this afternoon would agree that it really matters. What we need to understand what we're spending the money on and whether that's providing value. So if we go to the next slide, we at Dartmouth, under John Skinner, Jack Wenberg, and I came up with these terms about 5 years ago of effective care, preference-sensitive care, and supply-sensitive care. Effective care are things where we know that every patient would want those services, safe, reliable, effective care. Now, this was back in the 90s. Everyone would want to get their heart reperfusion for their heart attack as quickly as possible. In those days, 12 hours is a pretty good number. We now know that 90 minutes or even 60 minutes or 30 minutes is even better. But there are a number of treatments like that. The bars are to the left of that dotted line because the high-spending regions were less able to deliver effective care consistently. No one was doing a very good job. Averages were not 100%. But high-spending regions were less able to make sure that they delivered safe and effective care. Slightly less. Not dramatically less, but slightly less. It's also important to recognize that the variation across regions was much greater than the variation between high and low spending regions, and I will come back to that as well. On preference-sensitive care, these are services where we know that patients' preferences differ about the risks and benefits they face. If you take bypass surgery, for example, we know that it does not extend patients' lives in almost all circumstances. It does improve their chest pain. It also comes with the side effect of cognitive impairment. So the choice is really about in a small proportion of the patient, maybe 10 to 20% of the patient. So the choice there is really about whether you want to be able to exercise well or play tennis or whether you really don't care much about tennis but really want to make sure that you remember your daughter's name or where you put your keys when you came into the house. So we think for many of these procedures, the key issue is informing patients of the risks and benefits and letting their preferences drive the decision. And we know from a fair bit of empirical work led mostly by Annette O'Connor in Ontario and Mike Berry and others at Mass General Hospital that we as a profession, physicians don't do a tremendously good job about giving balanced information to their patients. We tend to be driven to some extent by our own beliefs about what works and perhaps a payment system that rewards us for doing more. The third category is, as you can see from this graph, where all the money goes in the differences between high and low spending regions. So this is in patients with a heart attack or a hip fracture or colon cancer, and this is the weighted average of all three, and they are nearly identical, these ratios. If you had one of those three conditions, you spent 60% more time in the hospital during the first year from the day after your initial diagnosis. You spent almost twice as much time in the ICU. Again, after adjusting for case mix differences and following patients for the year after their initial hospitalization. They're seen much more frequently by physicians, especially by medical specialists, and they get much higher rates of imaging and diagnostic tests, all quite close to that 61% higher rate of spending that I showed you between the pale areas and the red areas. So the additional spending in high-spending regions is not devoted to either more effective care or more preference-sensitive care. It's devoted to more of what we refer to as supply-sensitive care. So the next slide highlights two of those particular categories, inpatient days and evaluation and management visits, and I think the next slide, if I'm lucky, should say what does higher spending buy. We've been working with the Premier and the subset who are participating in their quality initiative, the Quest hospitals. And what we see across those hospitals are dramatic differences in the use of supply-sensitive services across these hospitals, whether it's inpatient days or physician visits. And these correspond very closely with, we are not yet ready to release any figures that might have gotten out, but they strongly predict how these hospitals treat patients after a heart attack or after another acute hospitalization. So let's go on to the next slide. That's the utilization question, and what do we gain in terms of health outcomes, physicians' perceptions, or patient perceived quality? And these are all national studies, so it's looking on average across the United States. And what we see is no gain in survival and no improvement in function over time for the cohorts that we've studied, on average for the country as a whole. Physicians' perceptions, we've interviewed physicians, and physicians in high-spending regions are more likely to say that the quality of communication among them and their colleagues is inadequate to provide high-quality care. They're more likely to report that it's more difficult coordinating care and ensuring adequate continuity with their patients. And in spite of having 30% more hospital beds per capita, they say it's harder to get your patients into the hospital. And in spite of having 65% more medical specialists per capita, they say it's harder to get your patients in to see a specialist. Patients do not report that care is better in those high-spending regions either. So if we go on to the next slide, this adds a recent study by Laura Yousaitis, John Skinner, and highlights rankings on quality, compares rankings on quality with, again, spending on cohorts of patients across these hospitals with serious chronic illness. What's really important to understand is essentially that per capita cost of care over time, when you follow patients over a period of time, are unrelated to quality. What we see in this slide are quality scores for hospitals in New York and Los Angeles, and they vary dramatically. There are good places and bad places in both on Medicare Compare data in both of these communities, and they also vary dramatically in terms of their costs within each community. So if we go forward the next slide, maybe this build will work. Yes. What you'll see is a red circle around the fact that some systems are able to achieve high, in both of those communities, are able to achieve high quality and low cost. And what's critical, and what I think, Dr. Rosenthal, Dr. Brookmeyer, and Dr. James and I think we'll end up on the same page, what really matters is what you spend it on and how we can improve care. So, moving forward, there are a few points of confusion, and I just want to try to at least clear those up so that we have a common understanding. And the next slide will show, this question of should we be looking back or should we be looking forward? And while not perfectly correlated, when we take cohorts of patients who've died and follow them backward and adjust for their chronic illnesses, and we take acute cohorts, whether it's of heart attack, colon cancer, on the left, that's Dr. John Skinner's work, and compare them going forward, there's a very strong correlation. So the information that is there in the end-of-life spending measures that are available for every hospital in the country is that it will help you get a signal about how intensively you treat cohorts of patients when you follow them forward. But the graph on the right, with all those fancy circles and little things that look like Celtic crosses in them, is a study by Amber Barnato in medical care where she looked at Pennsylvania hospitals and, again, compared follow-back intensity from death with follow-forward intensity among patients who were seriously ill, and again, found a very strong correlation. And this is for under 65 and over 65 populations in Pennsylvania. So that in terms of understanding intensity, the use of supply-sensitive care, the use of the hospital as a site of care, the frequency with which patients are seen, the numbers of diagnostic tests performed, end-of-life measures are an awfully useful indicator, highly reliable, of how your system treats patients over time when you follow them forward. Should we ever get to the point in the United States where bundled payments are occurring or where people are thinking about participating in accountable care organizations, I believe this information will be useful to you. Another point of confusion. Some have claimed that the differences in utilization across the United States are due to differences in poverty within communities. These are hospital-specific measures of resource use, again, for end-of-life populations, but in our annals work we showed that it was exactly the same going forward. There are huge differences for both low-income individuals and high-income individuals in how intensively they're treated across hospitals. each dot on the left-hand graph, this is the slide that says poverty at the top in red. Each dot represents the hospital days per patient during the last 2 years of life in major American academic medical centers. In major American medical centers, these are not solely academic, large hospitals, so that we could have adequate data. And on the right, you see the high-income patients. And the right-hand correlation shows that these are highly correlated. So it is really the differences in use of supply-sensitive care, overall intensity, are in fact a system attribute, an attribute of provider systems. And within those systems, we treat blacks or whites, high-income, low-income. We tend to treat those patients similarly within our systems compared to other systems which treat those patients with lower intensity. Let's go on to the third, another recent point of confusion. MedPAC published a study where they subtracted all other federal payments from and concluded that geographic and used different geographic measures, geographic definitions than we did, and concluded that the variations were moderated substantially when you controlled it, when you took out all federal spending. This graph actually shows that that's not true. There are some regions, particularly New York City, Manhattan, and the Bronx, where educational payments and disproportionate share payments make a huge, you know, contribute a lot to per capita spending on Medicare beneficiaries in those communities. But for most of the country, price-adjusted and non-price-adjusted measures of utilization are highly, highly correlated. This was published just a week ago in Health Affairs. So there are huge variations which are not accounted for by differences in prices. And then the last point of confusion is the degree to which these differences are due to differences in health. There is no question that health status is the most important determinant of spending, as the left-hand graph there shows. But as the right-hand graph shows from our New England Journal piece last summer, it explains only a small fraction of the regional differences in spending. So let's, you know, what I really think we should have a common understanding of is it's not either or, it's rather both and. There are some differences in utilization across communities and across hospitals that are clearly due to forces beyond providers' control, and some differences in spending. Poor patients clearly have inadequate social supports at home, and we need to figure out how to make sure that we're taking account of those when we evaluate hospital performance. Health status. Some providers in some regions do indeed have sicker patients. And prices do differ across regions. We don't want to, we must take account as we think about hospital payment systems of being sensible about what the input costs are in each community. And finally, I think, and very importantly, we are currently subsidizing the academic missions of our major academic medical centers through the fee-for-service payment system right now. And if we think about changing it, we better figure out a way to protect those the missions of those hospitals as we move forward constructively. All those things being said, it is both and. Remarkable differences in utilization remain. If you look, across whether you look across physicians, across care systems, or across regions, the little picture down at the bottom right-hand side there is from Tom Lee at Partners Healthcare, who they have looked at differences in imaging rates across the primary care physicians within their systems, accounting for differences in patients. And what they see is a five-fold difference in the frequency with which primary care physicians order high-cost imaging studies within the same, this graph is from a single one of their primary care practices. So the 15 or so physicians differ by a factor of five within that practice in their frequency of ordering advanced imaging. We see the same kind of thing whether it's across communities within Vermont or across the country. Most of the differences in spending are due to higher use of the hospital as a site of care and more frequent discretionary physician services. So what's going on? What might we do? We've done a fair bit, actually, to try to sort through the degree to which the differences in overall utilization across regions and hospitals are due to patient preferences. They're not. There is a slight preference for specialists in high specialist regions. That is, in the highest regions, which have 65% more specialists per capita, 28% of patients say it's better to have a specialist manage your care, each problem. In the low-spending regions, it's 21%, or in the low-specialist regions, it's 21%. So there's clearly some element of preferences here. But on the other, you know, when you ask them if they would want a test that the patient, that the, your physician says you could have but it wasn't needed, there's no difference across regions, and no differences in preferences for end-of-life care. Now, practice is clearly important. Explains about 10% of the differences in spending, and we should probably do something about it. But the capacity and payment system are also clearly important. Capacity plays a major role, and the payment system we know that we're living with requires physicians and hospitals to maintain their margins. They have to keep their revenues adequate, have to keep the beds full, have to keep the office full. But what's very interesting is capacity only explains about 50% of the differences across communities. So we've gone further to try to figure out what's going on and explaining differences, and that's the slide that says what's going on, the role of clinical judgment. For those of you who I didn't remind you, hope you can catch up. What we did is we used a clinical vignettes with patients around, with physicians around the country, and compared two kinds of decisions, evidence-based decisions where there was strong guidelines that said this is the way to treat somebody. And they, although doctors sometimes disagreed, the frequency with which they said one thing or another was completely unrelated to regional differences in spending. There is a second kind of question that we asked where physician judgment was truly required to answer the question. Prototypical example would be for a patient with well-controlled high blood pressure and no other medical problems, when would you schedule the next visit? We were clued off that this might be, clued into the notion that this might be an interesting measure when the focus groups in Oregon, the physician said, well, every 6 months, and the focus groups in Miami said every month. There were a number of other questions, about 20 other items, that all held together very well to predict an individual physician's likelihood of intervening when there was substantial clinical uncertainty. And the next slide shows this graph, which really shows quite clearly that this, you know, propensity to intervene, clinical judgment in gray areas, is what really is most strongly associated with differences in spending. So what explains differences in clinical judgment, you know, in the gray areas? I think, you know, we still have more work to do here, and I'm going to move beyond, you know, strong peer-reviewed published work to some case studies, but that I think still start to give us some insights about what may be contributing here. You know, and this would be on the slide that says what's going on, case studies. You know, if you compare McAllen and La Crosse, one of the highest spending places in the country with one of the lowest spending places in the country, markedly different growth rates, you really get a different sense of what those communities are about. In the first case, you know, Atul Gawande described McAllen as a medical community that came to treat patients the way subprime mortgage lenders treated home buyers, as profit centers, whereas Jeff Thompson at Gunderson Lutheran said, you know, we're a culture that focuses on the well-being of the community, not just the financial health of our system. He was deeply committed to the financial health of his system, and as we've learned subsequently, he has to raise his rates substantially to the private sector, or believes he does, more so than some other places. But nonetheless, in terms of utilization, for both their under 65 and their over 65, they're a very low utilization system. So something about the aims of our local delivery system seems to be very important as well. What game they think they're playing? And so if I get to some principles to guide reform, I'm increasingly convinced, and colleague, you know, Mark McClellan, with whom we're working on accountable care organizations, our diagnoses fall on the left-hand column of this slide. I think as a country and as providers, we're still a little confused about what our aims are, what we're trying to produce. Are we in McAllen, where our job is fundamentally about business and running a business, a healthcare business? Or are we more like Jeff Thompson with this sense of accountability to our community? So I think one of the things we need to think about is whether we should clarify our aims and aim explicitly to achieve better health, better care, and lower costs for both our patients and communities. That's where, you know, we think the aim should rest, McClellan and I. I think we have absent or poor data that leaves practice unexamined and the public assuming that more is always better. We need much better information that engages physicians, provides them feedback on their practice, supports improvement, the kind of work you'll hear about later this afternoon, and informs consumers. I think the third is probably what I think is the most important problem we face, is that the public and most clinicians believe that health is produced by the individual actions of good clinicians working hard. And I think we're understanding, from the work particularly that Brent James has led over the last 20 years, that's not correct. If we look at industries that have really improved quality, it's the system. And therefore, we need to establish organizations that are accountable for aims and capable of redesigning practice and managing capacity. I'd add that, managing capacity, because I think it's critical to the future solvency of the United States. And finally, the fourth problem is the wrong incentives, that reinforce this fragmented model, that reward fragmentation, that induce more care and support the kind of entrepreneurial behavior that we see in some communities. So we need to rethink our incentives, realign our incentives, both financial and professional. I do want to I didn't emphasize it back when we were talking about McCallum, but I think we as an industry are at great risk if we are seen to be purely entrepreneurs, if we are seen to be in it for the money. And I think we have a great opportunity to realign our work with our values. That's what I'll spend the rest of my presentation trying to talk about, how I might think about it. How do we move forward? So, moving forward. If you look at this new policy environment that we're in, it's a very heartening world. Maybe not in Congress, but on the ground in Washington, I see very promising work afoot. First is, I think there is alignment on aims. The National Priorities Partners, many of you have participated, really had six aims, but they can be collapsed to those three pretty efficiently. Better health, better care, lower costs. There's consensus on performance measurement. And the key question, which is I think the question Dr. Rosenthal asks eloquently in their work across centers, is how did the patient do over the relevant time course? And recognizing that value is multidimensional, that we have to look at outcomes, we have to look at how patients have done, we have to look at quality, costs, and whether the care was aligned with patients' preferences. But the fundamental challenge to doing either to accountability for health and health outcomes or to measuring it is that we have to be able to follow patients over time and become accountable for their care. And most of us aren't set up very well to do that yet. Now, I'm going to pause and talk about the value index. And I imagine we have some people listening who are strong proponents of the value index, and we have some people listening who are quite upset about it. And I fall on the conclusion that it's a well-intentioned approach, but it's not the right approach. Its intent is correct. We should not criticize the goal, that is, to improve the value of care, but the approach, which creates a simple regional score of quality and per capita costs, and some of them even thought we should use the Dartmouth Atlas data as it was just for this. The problem is that the method was to identify high quality, low cost regions and increase the fees on each service there, and similarly identify low quality, high cost places and cut their fees. Well, the problem are a couple fold. One is that because it's a regional index, it punishes good providers in poorly performing regions and similarly rewards bad providers in high performing regions. But equally important, the response to any cuts in fees are not likely to be constructive in a world that's trying to slow the growth of healthcare spending. We know that what would happen, physicians would buy more, physicians would order more ancillary services because they're already working full-time, hospitals would have to make be careful that they increase the volume of high margin services or positive margin services. So we really need to figure out how to help all providers improve the value of care. And this is about how we design payment systems to support improved value. So there are basically three models out there, and I'll spend just a few minutes on each one and before wrapping up. One is episode or bundled payments. You know, the notion is to give a single payment that creates incentives for providers to work together to improve care and reduce costs within the episode. You can imagine inpatient and post-acute care, for example, or for major elective procedures. You know, there are efforts to develop and test approaches underway. Geisinger is probably furthest along. But there's not yet a lot of evidence that this will really work. And there are a few issues that need to be thought about. It does still require an organization to either accept or distribute payments, and certainly requires, someone to pull the providers together to coordinate care. Quality and outcome measures are available, but they're difficult to deploy in current practice. We really aren't assessing patient functional outcomes very well. And it may not reduce overall costs because the incentive remains to increase the number of episodes. There is no motivation under an episode-based payment model to ensure that patients are receiving informed patient choice. The second model, patient-centered medical home, is also very promising. It's as I'm sure you're all aware, practice redesigned to support the core functions of primary care, payment reform to support currently non-reimbursed activities. The current status, it looks pretty promising in integrated systems that have been able to implement it. The published data is really largely from group health, but it's very exciting and important. It looks very promising in terms of both patient experience, physician experience, and overall cost. But the challenges under the medical home model is that responsibility for coordination still rests entirely with primary care practice. And the impact on costs are going to be uncertain. There are no explicit incentives or accountability for overall costs built into the patient-centered medical home model unless it's embedded in an integrated delivery system that can capture those savings. And therefore, community costs may not be affected. You know, specialists in hospitals are unlikely to allow their incomes to fall. So if we go on to the next slide, there we are. Thank you. Accountable care organizations. This is a proposal that Mark McClellan and I, people at MedPAC, are interested in. The notion is to establish or encourage the formation of provider organizations that can effectively manage the full continuum of care as a real or virtually integrated delivery system. There needs to be performance measurement to ensure the focus on demonstrably improving care and lowering costs and reassure the public that, that reduced costs aren't just being achieved through stinting on needed care. And then, of course, you have to have payment reform. And the basic model is to figure out ways of rewarding providers for reducing costs if they've met quality thresholds. The easiest one is to establish target spending levels based on what current spending is. If you come in below a target, that would be some standard amount of an increase next year, you would be rewarded with a share of those savings. The nice thing about the model is it can work in high spending and low spending regions and would reward providers in both high cost and low cost systems for improving their care and realigning care with what their patients want. The model as developed does not require beneficiary lock-in. There are a diverse set of hospitals and organizations that could become ACOs. So this is the slide that has potential ACOs. Whether it's integrated delivery systems, hospitals, physician networks, or community networks, what we know from the epidemiologic analysis of clinical practice is that most physicians practice in natural referral networks around one or a couple of hospitals. There are a few exceptions around the country, but by and large, the average is that about 70%, if you assign physicians empirically to the hospital they use most frequently and look at their patients, 70% of the care for those patients is provided by that network of physicians, and 70% of the medical admissions are to that hospital. So it's, at least for most places, it would not be a radical disruption of care. The evidence is limited, but it's promising. You know, the physician group practice demonstration had by now looks pretty promising, although there's some concern that the cost savings have been achieved in part through overcoding of diagnoses by all of the groups, as they've learned how to make sure that under the risk adjustment model used, they capture the benefits of better risk adjustment as opposed to improved clinical practice. So I think that's the concern that's still out there about the PGP demo. But if you look at there are a couple of examples where both in the over 65 and the under 65 population, hospitals or health systems had a critical mass of payers working with them to align incentives, and Geisinger would be the preeminent example. We really had pretty promising results. So Medicare spending per capita for Geisinger fell about 15% relative to where they would have been if spending had continued to grow at the rate of the rest of the country. And they were remarkably able, because of their health plan lowering costs within those communities, in one community, the school board, because health plan costs didn't rise at all, was able to give their teachers a $7,000 raise. And in a country where all wage growth over the last 10 years has been devoted to the increased cost of health care benefits on average, that kind of progress, to me, tells us a nice story, but perhaps it's only because I'm a former school board chair. I'm glad at least someone was laughing. It's good to. I think that we're the accountable care organization model is moving forward. The both leg, both bills include a national program. Several states are advancing the notion, and we're working with Brookings in our collaborative, and have three pilot sites that are up and running now. With their private payers, getting ready for Medicare to join us, we expect. This is the slide that says initial pilot sites. So we've been working over the last 8 months with these three sites, and they're now working with each of their payers, and these are all three of them hospital-based systems, to establish a shared savings model, to agree on initial performance measures that'll be the starter set, and create the context within which they can be rewarded for care improvement and capture the savings that we'll see, I think, that now, if you in fee-for-service, if you improve care and reduce readmissions or do a better job, you actually lose money. So if I were to optimistically play value-based payment forward, as the top of this slide says, I would see a future in which ACOs seek to improve care management, reduce costs as much as possible, considering how best to provide care, align care with patients and their caregivers' value, and then make really careful decisions about what they wanted to do themselves versus what they'd send elsewhere. I will say that in all three of our pilot sites, the conversation has begun about whether their hospital should offer all services or whether, under an ACO model, they would be better of referring some high-cost services that others might do better on to other institutions, so they can actually provide better care to their patients at lower cost, while themselves specializing in certain things that they would hope to recruit those patients from other settings. So referral centers, academic medical centers, in this future world would need to demonstrate value and be able to deliver high-quality, low-cost episodes, and therefore capture market share for wanted and needed episodes. They would also have a pretty strong incentive to manage their own primary care populations as ACOs. So I think that, as I think about the challenge faced by, hospital leaders, considering variations in practice across the nation and across hospitals, is we should understand that there are remarkable variations in discretionary use of the hospital, and that probably is one of the lowest, our greatest opportunities to slow spending growth by becoming more efficient about how we use the hospital as a site of care. I think we will need to consider the future role of the hospital in a world where the aim is to lower the overall costs in communities and for patient populations. even if we're in fee-for-service now, it may be worth thinking about hedging. You know, what do you do to prepare for a new payment environment? And in that respect, I think, you know, ACOs and thinking about how you participate in bundled payments are probably something many will want to start thinking about, even if it's only to hedge their bets that the fee-for-service system may not be around forever. So let me end with what I hope is an optimistic story. So some of you will have been aware that last summer, Atul Gawande, Don Berwick, myself, and Mark McClellan invited 10 communities to come to Washington to tell their stories. We identified 74 high-performing regions where costs were low or had been coming down substantially, and quality was high or had been improving substantially. We had 10 diverse communities that we invited to come to Washington, and a number of common themes sort of emerged from the teams that were brought, most of them including, all of them including hospital leaders, many of them actually led by hospital leaders. And there was a common sense of shared aims, accountability to the community, a strong foundation of primary care, physician engagement as leaders. In all of these communities, savings had been achieved through reduced use of the hospital, often requiring collaboration among hospitals, working with state authorities to deal with the regulatory issues around antitrust issues that two hospitals are going to collaborate, or working under the Certificate of Need program, as in Virginia, to revamp their local hospital systems, but with a smaller overall footprint. They all use data to drive change. But, about 3 months after this conference was over, I realized that there was something else about the participants that we'd met, that all four of us had missed at the time. And it's really captured in this next cartoon by Barzotti, which has two hospital leaders standing side by side saying, there it is again, the invisible hand of the marketplace giving us the finger. You know, I now travel a lot, and talking to physicians or talking to many hospital leaders, there is this sense that we're kind of, among some, not all by any stretch of the imagination, but some, that they're victims, that it's the patient's fault, or it's the payer's fault, or Medicare's not paying us enough, or it's malpractice. There's a real sense of victimhood. And what emerged, all of the people who came to our conference, look at this next slide, they were self-confident. They were engaged. They had this high sense of self-efficacy, this sense, if not us who, and they were having fun. They all had this sense that they were striving in a very difficult environment to connect their work with their values. So I'll end with that. I think we have a great opportunity here, to redesign healthcare, not ration, and not raise healthcare spending beyond what's affordable for the American public. And thanks for the chance to talk this afternoon.
Well, Dr. Fisher, thank you very much. That was a great presentation. And I'm the one who laughed about your board seat. I thought it was pretty good, and I have a kind of a similar perspective here, so I appreciate your comment. Operator, could we...
E followed by the 1 key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they're received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, press star 2. Again, that's star 1 to ask a question. We have one question from Dr. Hubert Pardon.
Hi, it's Herb Pardon. Elliot, thank you for a very interesting presentation. I want to say, first of all, that I take the assumption, as you said, that all of us are in here to improve quality, and the last thing we should be in is just pursuing money. So I share your value. You commented that you seem to have some difference with the MedPAC study. My impression from the paper that I read that you guys put out a week or two ago was that you acknowledged the fact that looking at services rather than spending contracted the level of variation. I don't think anybody could sensibly say there's no variation. There's obviously variations, as you said, all over the place. But it seems to me that as you were talking, There were a number of factors which one might say it's a small factor here, it's a small factor there, and that the cumulative effect is a number of different factors, whatever level of influence they have, influencing the ultimate level of spending or service utilization in a given area. I guess one question I have, would you agree to that? Second question I would have is, how much are we taking cognizance of, we talk about patient preference, but the fact that there are different cultures of health behavior in different kinds of communities, how much are we taking cognizance of that, and how much of an influence is that?
First, thank you for the question. Nice to hear your voice again. We're in agreement that that if you account for all of the factors simultaneously, some of the variation goes away. What's interesting and what's important is that there are places which look lower spending, where when you look at services, they go up. So that if you remember the graph that we showed, there is still tremendous variation. Some have interpreted the MedCat report to say that the Dartmouth Atlas is wrong on the magnitude of the variation, and I don't think we're very wrong. You can look at our heart attack patients and follow them forward through a year across hospitals, as we've done, using standard, adjusting for illness, and it's still almost the same. Now, all that said, you're absolutely right that we have to take account of those other factors as we move forward to think about designing payment models, changing policies. I would want to make, and on your specific question about culture, many of you will have seen the paper published by Joe Antino, which came out in JAMA this week, looking at feeding tube places in patients with advanced dementia. And New York is high on those measures, and we should not be surprised given that perhaps this could be explained by a high prevalence of a high population of Orthodox Jews in New York. It could contribute to that. That may well be true in Los Angeles as well. So I'm about advocating aligning treatment as best we can with patients' preferences.
Let me just say, I for one do not feel that the MedPAC study says that the Dartmouth study is wrong. I think my feeling about it, and it's a very complicated presentation, which was very good for you in a short period of time, which I'd like to discuss, is that what's probably applicable is that there are multiple factors which have various degrees of influence on the ultimate spending and health services utilization, and to the extent we can be comprehensive in covering them all, we'll have the most accurate picture.
I agree. I agree completely, and we'll work on trying to improve our measures. We are working on it. What I'd want listeners to understand is that if the data that we have so far, imperfect as it is, when you look at the hospital-specific measures of end-of-life care, for example, which is now available in every hospital in the country, it may be, off by 10 or 20% for a given place, given the factors that you talk about, but it's not going to take a place from being, in the top half of the distribution and put it in the bottom half. And so there's some useful guidance if systems are trying to think about, episode payment is coming, we better think about how we're going to become thoughtful. The data about how frequently patients are admitted, how many days people spend in the hospital across hospitals, will be pretty useful insight to thinking about whether it's worth rethinking the way you use the hospital or long-term care hospitals or nursing homes or other hospitals as a site of care. Does that make sense, Herb? I'm perfectly open to...
I don't want to hog the time here. I'm looking forward to you and I having an opportunity to talk in a more leisurely way, because I think it could be useful certainly for me, I hope for you as well. But
I'm sure it will be. Look forward to it.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Caroline Steinberg.
Hi, this is Caroline Steinberg from the American Hospital Association. I guess as any good health services researcher, one of the first questions I ask myself about any proposal is, how will this fly with my elderly relatives at Thanksgiving dinner? And I think in the Accountable Care Organization that we've been sort of skirting around, I think it's probably a political third rail, is this issue of beneficiary choice. And I look at, you know, two groups of relatives I have, one that live in the New York City area and another group that live in rural Wyoming. And the way they tend to get care is one relative had, I guess, two major episodes involving surgery over the last 3 to 5 years, and then has several chronic conditions. And he's very engaged in his health care and does tons of research. And he ascertained that, you know, in order to get his orthopedic care, that the best place for him was Greenwich. And in order to get his, you know, for the cancer episode, the best place was Mount Sinai. And then for his several chronic conditions, he tends to get, you know, he wants to get the free, you know, the free medications, and so he tends to go to the VA. And I just see, like, how does that work in an accountable care organization when you've got very engaged patients, you know, wanting to make different choices in terms of the networks that they want to get care from? And I also, when I was thinking about my rural relatives in Wyoming, that you'd think in a rural area that they would have fewer choices, but they tend to operate in very much the same way. They drive 100 miles in one direction for orthopedic care, 100 miles in the other direction for cancer care, and then if it's something like really major, like, you know, maybe a heart surgery or something, they'll go either to Billings or Denver. But they're really very much engaged in their own decisions. They ask their family members, and I'm not even sure how much they really are. You know, they kind of choose their doctors, and I'm having trouble figuring out how, without actually making an effort to constrain beneficiary choice, you're going to achieve what we want in the accountable care organizations.
Well, the first thing is that we know empirically, at least for elderly patients, that most of their, you know, as I said earlier, most, if you've got 70% of the people staying within network, it's actually enough to make these, you know, shared savings models work. It worked in the 10 sites that were participating in the PGP demo. So you don't need to lock people in. People can still have freedom of choice. We might prefer it as a policy, you know, the ideal policy wonk might say, I want to tie people to a provider, but the public won't buy that. The reason the AARP, you know, endorsed the ACL approach or supported it in staff, you know, on the Hill, was that we were not constraining beneficiaries' choice. We were encouraging people to be accountable. And what the PGP sites did was start to help patients make wiser choices about where they wanted to go, not to try to constrain their choices. But the second issue, you know, with the private payers, there's actually, you know, certainly no restriction on their ability to define different networks and, you know, use co-payments to define more or less restricted networks on the under 65. So that's some of the conversation that's going on with the private payers will be around, in fact, maybe you could use some incentives. And we've certainly talked in theory that for Medicare, you might want to move to, you know, some kind of incentive to stay within network or go to someone who's recommended by your provider or negotiated by your provider rather than. So there could be, what we're pretty convinced, though, is that without some fundamental change in the payment model, we're not going to slow the growth of healthcare spending. Mm-hmm. And we haven't been able to, you know, think of any other way besides either forcing everybody into tightly capitated arrangements and join a Kaiser, but there aren't Kaisers everywhere in the country, or bundled payments which do not address the problem of overall cost.
Okay, you know, another area I think of concern too is the fact that in terms of hospital physician relations, I think there's been more sort of fragmentation in recent years than there has been integration, and that one of the fastest growing service areas is office-based procedures, various freestanding facilities, including ACOs, and even now, you know, single specialty, physician-owned specialty hospitals. And I'm just wondering sort of how you see, you know, what approach do you get those organizations into the fold?
Well, I think, you know, there's no question it's going to be work. There's been a little swing backwards, as far as I understand, from the people at the Center for Health System Change toward, in the last 2 years, much greater alignment with many physicians and hospitals. So there's still some places where there's clearly fragmented, competitive markets. But I think we'll, this is clearly, it's going to be an evolution here. If I were betting, or I would imagine that 2 or 3 years from now, if we find that the models turn out to be successful, it will look like it's more fun to be in a system that's supporting you in your clinical improvement efforts, as I think we'll hear from Dr. James later this afternoon. So it may look like it's more fun to practice in that environment. There may look to be greater income security. And third, I think the payers may well start to, both Medicare and private payers may, if the model is successful, then say, well, fee increases under traditional fee for service are going to be smaller if you're not in an ACO. And, McCall and I worked on an amendment that we'd hope to get people to buy into as a substitute for the value index that would have done that, that would have said, look, we want everybody to, you can stay in fee-for-service, but your updates are going to be smaller unless you're willing to be, in an accountable practice that's for doing the performance measurement and moving toward new payment models.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Chris Bailey.
Good afternoon. This is Chris Bailey from Richmond, Virginia, where the weather feels much like New England.
I bet.
Unusually. Thank you for your presentation. I had a question about whether you had any comments on the Chernew article that was in the American Journal of Managed Care recently that seemed to suggest that there was imperfect correlation between regions that had low rates of Medicare spending and private healthcare spending.
Yeah, we're actually doing a fair bit of work there, some with Mike, some in, with some colleagues of Mike's, and some on our own. What I think the evidence will show when it emerges is that utilization rates across regions under 65 and over 65 are highly correlated. And it will show that that the reasons per capita spending on the under 65 and over 65 is not perfectly correlated or is weakly correlated at best, is that some places have much higher prices, and it seems to be more in the lower spending Medicare places than in the higher spending Medicare places, where this differential between private sector, the prices charged to private payers is greater. What's interesting, so, and then there's a third piece of evidence which I suspect will emerge, actually I know it will emerge, it's just I can't tell you when, that there are plenty of places which are low utilization for Medicare, low utilization for the under 65, and don't have marked price differentials, so that per capita costs for the under 65 and over 65 are low for both populations. And the hospitals are doing fine financially. That is, their margins are positive. So what I'm increasingly believing is likely to be important for us to think about is, how do we redesign care to minimize utilization so that we can, that's one way to reduce cost. The second is how to reduce the cost of a given specific service so that we don't have to cross-subsidize from the private sector the Medicare fees. And ideally, we'd align the fees for everybody so the prices, so that what prices Medicare and private payers had to pay were the same, and then everyone would face the incentive to really figure out how to take waste out of the current system. Does that make sense?
It does. That helps.
Thank you.
Excuse me. How many questions do you have lined up? Do you know?
We have 2 questions.
Okay. If we could try and handle those 2, and then we're scheduled to take a brief interlude, so maybe we could cut it off there.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Next question comes from Kurt Norris.
Dr. Fisher, thanks for your presentation. We've just recently done some work in-state with Larson Allen to establish some benchmarks that incorporate both quality as well as financial benchmarks. And one of the insights, and we're just rolling this out with our membership right now, but one of the insights that we found of interest and our members are finding of interest is that one of the strongest indicators of whether or not you're going to be a high-quality performer, and again, this is just within Iowa institutions, is your ability to manage your expenses. And I was just wondering if you had any observations relative to either your research or other folks' research that you read on that point.
Gosh, you know, I don't know the research on that topic. It aligns with what it seems to me, it makes sense with what I've heard from some of the premier participants. But I really would love to see some better data on it. It does make complete sense that if you can manage your costs, you can also But the question is, are they paying attention to both?
Yeah, and actually, what our report that we're rolling out to our members indicates is that they're focused primarily on operations and expenses is in large measure what's leading to some of these other results.
There was a nice study in the AAMC journal, and I'm blocking on the authors, about high-quality institutions and the role of leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very impressive that the places that had the highest quality scores, and when they looked at across a bunch of indicators, had some very special, very specific leadership attributes when they did site visits. So that may be related as well. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Our next question, next and final question, comes from Linda Quick.
Good afternoon, and thank you. As an old friend of Jack Winberg's and Phil Capers, I need to ask you, coming from the Miami, South Florida area, one question about this: the difference in the utilization by payer that's coming up here now. We've always been the poster children for overutilization because of excess capacity and then higher costs for Medicare. It clearly seems to be true for Medicaid and for private insurance. But ironically, for the first time now in the last couple of years, we're also seeing overutilization by the no-pay patient. The no reimbursement service and the physicians and hospitals still get the patients. Is that the market finger you were alluding to, or has anyone actually now decided that it's okay to compete for the uninsured?
Gosh, you know, I don't know the answer to that. I simply don't. It's a very interesting. I would want to know more about whether there's any reimbursement system, whether there's any uncompensated care pool or something that helps them.
Well, there is, but it's substantially less than the amount provided. Our one public teaching institution claims to do about $600 million a year of charity care by itself, and all of my members combined do about $1 billion a year. But they have local tax support equaling about $392 million. So, but somebody's providing the value of care to patients for whom there is no compensation. And it used to be that we could say that, you know, where the money is where the doctors and the hospitals go. But when you're not getting paid at all, it's hard to understand the overutilization.
Well, on one hand, good if they're getting care. But it's certainly worth further. It's worth looking into further.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, everyone. Dr. Fisher, thank you so much again. And if I understood correctly, you're going to be hanging on for the remainder of the discussions.
Yeah, happy to listen in on my colleagues.
Well, great. We're going to have a.
Oh, I'm sure I'll learn something.
Well, and at the end, we're going to have a little more extended period for Q&A, so if you're willing, we may be able to catch up with some other questions for you at the end.
Sure.
We have about 7 or 8 minutes. We're scheduled to have our next speaker start at, I'm in Eastern Time Zone at 3,
So my suggestion is you put your phone on mute and take a stretch, and we'll be back right about 3 o'clock Eastern Time, 2 o'clock Central Time, and so it goes. Fair enough? Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your patience in holding. Our speakers are again in conference.
Well, we're back. Again, thanks to Dr. Fisher for a terrific presentation, and I have a feeling we're going to keep up with that outstanding level of quality. I'm going to turn it over to Nancy again, and she's going to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Brent James.
Thank you again, Scott, and welcome to all of you coming back into the conference. We do have a second speaker today, Dr. Brent James, who is known to many of you, or you may even have had the opportunity to hear him before speak at an IHI conference or on many of the forums that deal with the use of information technology in healthcare. He is certainly well known for his work in quality improvement and the way he brings practical experience from making things work at Intermountain Healthcare to the realm of public policy. Dr. James is the Chief Quality Officer and Executive Director of the Institute for Healthcare Delivery Research at Intermountain. He really is an international figure for his work in quality improvement and patient safety, with a real focus on building a foundation for improvement that includes looking at culture change, data systems, payment methods, and the important role of management. He is trained as a general surgeon and in oncology, but also holds a bachelor's degree in computer science and medical biology and a master's in statistics. He has faculty appointments at the University of Utah, at Harvard School of Public Health, and the University of Sydney. So he's well-traveled as well. I'm glad to welcome Dr. James to our conference call today. Brent, please, take it from here.
Thanks very much, Nancy. I'm going to take a slightly different view, perhaps, on variation analysis than many others do. I first encountered it when I showed up at Intermountain in 1986. We were looking at variation from the perspective of change, how you could use an understanding of variation to drive change in clinical care delivery. So when you talk about it in theory, you can find some very, very interesting conclusions. To my mind, though, that becomes real when you take that theory and show effective action that changes convincing positive results in terms of what we achieve for our patients when they seek our care. When I got to Intermountain back in 1986, we were working on a series of studies called Quality, Utilization, and Efficiency Studies. Truth is, as we saw them as a direct extension of the general variation literature, primarily work done at Dartmouth, to be honest, the first area we studied was transurethral prostatectomy, partly because it had been so well studied in other centers. We looked at a different slice, though. Most of that point had examined primarily hospitalization rates. They used insurance claims databases to look at the rates at which patients were hospitalized on a geographic population basis. We took it the next step. We said, okay, let's say that we have a patient who has been hospitalized with a particular condition. Are they treated the same? The quality portion of the study, we tried to, identify every comorbidity on presentation and explicitly stage each one individually relative to whether it would change the process of care. Identify every complication during a patient's hospitalization, stage it individually relative to whether it would have changed the process of care. Track long-term outcomes to see if we achieved our therapeutic goals. We ended up dividing out that subset of patients who were statistically clean. So far as we could tell, the same on presentation with the same outcome. Had to fairly carefully examine whether bias was introduced through that process, of course. And then thought that was a fair comparison group to look across physicians, let's say, or nursing units, or across hospitals or time periods. I'm going to show you a bit of the physician data. The short version, we discovered the same sort of variation down at this granular, closer to the frontline level, that others had been showing in terms of hospitalization rates. Just to illustrate, two factors that our urologic surgeons had identified as critical when performing a transurethral prostatectomy On this slide, 16 urologists with statistically meaningful numbers of cases. The little green boxes represent true surgical cut time. The little red circles are grams of prostatic tissue removed, two factors that our urologist had said were critical when performing the procedure. 16 surgeons, again, with statistically meaningful numbers of cases. Well, I've laid them out in order of grams per minute. At the far left, you have physician M, who took 40 minutes on median to remove 40 grams of tissue per patient. Far right, physician F, 90 minutes to remove 17 grams of tissue per patient. In terms of variation, the range in surgical procedure times, 90 minutes to a low of 38 minutes with physician K, that's just a little bit more than a 2.5-fold difference, 250% multiplicative or 150% additive difference. In terms of grams of prostatic tissue removed, it ranges from a low of 13 grams per patient, physician G, to a high of 42 with physician J. That's just a little bit more than a 3-fold difference, 300% multiplicative or 200% additive difference. The thing that's most interesting about the slide, of course, is the fact that the longer someone operated, the less tissue they removed, which is certainly not what we expected to see. The reason we laid the data out this way, just in passing, is because our surgeon suggested it. We were looking for an association between grams per minute and the primary complication of the procedure, reobstruction within 1 year of initial hospitalization that required reoperation to restore urine flow. It concentrated in the three rightmost physicians, physicians E, G, and F, and had a very strong statistical association with grams per minute. Carry it one step further. About half of the factors that we tracked came from our activity-based costing system, where you individually record every unit of service delivered to a patient, every lab test, every dose of a drug, every imaging exam, acuity-adjusted hour of nursing services, acuity-adjusted minute in surgery. About half of them, about 45 factors, had costs associated with them. So we rolled them up. What we found, again, was fairly profound variation. As you can see with physician M, about $1,164 hospital dollars, not counting physician's fees, to achieve a good outcome on a standard patient. Physician H was spending roughly twice that amount, $2,233. In fact, if we skip back a few slides to the full list of areas that we studied over a two-year time period, transurethral prostatectomy, open cholecystectomy, total hip arthroplasty, coronary artery bypass graft surgery, permanent pacemakers, and community-acquired pneumonia, we showed a similar range of variation within every procedure that we studied. The smallest amount of variation we ever measured across more than 1,000 comparisons was about 60%. I mean, if one person were using 10 of something to get the job done, someone else was using 16 of the same thing to get the same outcome on the same patient, so far as we could tell. The largest range of variation we measured was about 460%. That means if one person were using 10 of something to achieve a good outcome, somebody else was using 56 of the same thing to get the same outcome on the same patient. In short, we found huge variation across physician practice for the same condition within a hospital on carefully balanced patients. Now, of course, this isn't definitive by any stretch of the imagination. A series of statistical issues associated with them in terms of potential bias, in terms of statistical power, especially around complication rates that we were tracking through this thing. The real results came when we started to feed the data back. We did it in a blinded fashion. Our real interest was process, not picking bad or good surgeons. It took a little while to get our surgeons to buy into that, but we were successful in doing it. Here's how it felt. You're sitting in the room. We present the data. You realize that one of your colleagues is doing it very differently from how you do it and appears to be getting good results. Now, in most circumstances, the surgeons or other physicians explicitly ask for our help in understanding the differences. On occasion, they just did it on their own, frankly. What we saw was fairly massive decrease in variations. This is an old slide that I include for historic purposes. It's our first attempt at statistical process control. It was the third area we studied, total hip arthroplasty. This is Utah Valley Regional Medical Center, a big tertiary hospital in Provo, Utah, about 450 beds. 5 orthopedic surgeons. What you see to the far left, January of 1988, we shared this group's variation data with them. Well, it was Utah Valley and the rest of our system, so a series of others, about 8 hospitals perhaps, quite a number of surgeons. What it showed, of course, was massive variation. The center line shows the average length of stay within a particular year. In 1988, 10 days. 1988, 7.5 days. 1990, 7.26 days. Now, it's important to know that this was in the time period before we started to manage length of stay as a system, using skilled nursing facilities, step-down units, those sorts of tools. This was pretty much the surgeons on their own, completely. More important, the red dotted lines show plus or minus 2 standard deviations. It's a visual measure of variation within the group. What you'll notice is over the period of the slide, the distance of the red line from the green, the variation declined by more than a factor of 3. In fact, starting in about July or August of 1989, we could no longer identify significant variation among surgeons in terms of length of stay. For all the world, it's like they had developed a protocol on the fly, mostly by comparing their practices across the group. Another interesting factor, way back in 1988, one of the surgeons was already practicing the way that you see in 1990. This was not so much the group developing new methods as adopting an existing method within the group with some small modifications, frankly. It took them about a year, but they came to a de facto protocol on how they delivered care in a learning lab where they could learn across all practices instead of being isolated as a single physician in their own world. Oh, this turned out to have a fairly significant impact in other important ways. This slide shows what happened to our true internal cost per case. We run activity-based costing. We maintain an accurate cost master. So it is true resource consumption. Our cost per case for total arthroplasty fell from about $13,000 per case to about $8,000 in direct conjunction with that learning lab on our front line. This slide right here, this particular one, is where the administration of Intermountain became very, very interested in variation analysis. The world changed. These studies cost about $100,000 a piece to conduct. Of course, now this was back in 1986, a lot more money than it is today. But the world went from you're going to spend how much, Brent, to study what, to be how fast do you think you can do how many of these? A real change in attitude. Well, a friend introduced me at that time to W. Edwards Deming. Dr. Paul Batalden saw our QUE studies and said it reminded him of the work of a statistician in industry. Met Dr. Deming and discovered that he had a body of theory that seemed to describe what we were observing in our variation analysis. Deming carried it a step further, though. That general theory made the argument that quality controls cost. Well, technically, here's what Deming really said. He said all productive human work happens at the level of process. And what we actually control or use when we're delivering care is process. Every process consistently produces 3 classes of outcomes. What he called a physical outcome, well, in healthcare we'd call it a medical outcome. That's the term we usually use quality to describe. A cost outcome and a service outcome. His point was that quality and cost are two sides of the same coin, and you really can't divide them away from each other. Well, he then defined 3 hard causal mechanisms. For 2 of the 3, as you improve your physical outcome quality, it physically causes your cost to decline. Admittedly, there's a 3rd category where higher quality costs more, but the first 2 turned out to be large, so we started to focus efforts around the first 2, that sweet spot where higher quality meant lower costs. It pretty much always centered around process management, really thinking of it as variation control. we eventually generalized the solution to something we call shared baselines. It was our way of extending variation analysis, frankly. And think of it this way. You pull together a team of health professionals, the physicians, the nurses, the pharmacists, the therapists, the technicians, around a specific clinical entity. You hammer out an evidence-based best practice guideline. Now, without going into the detail, it's pretty easy to show that you cannot write a protocol that perfectly fits any patient, except in some very rare circumstances. Therefore, when you're using your shared baseline, well, you blend it into workflows at the front line. So you don't train the physicians and expect them to somehow remember it. You actually build it into the flow of work. But the rule is, doctors, nurses, we don't just allow or even encourage. We demand that you adapt our shared baselines to your individual patient needs. In a very real sense, they're the opposite of cookbook medicine. It takes your most important resource, trained expert mind, that physician, that nurse, and focuses their time and attention where their skills have the biggest impact, on that relatively small subset of factors that need to be adjusted and adapted. We have about 50 of these, or more than 50 of them, running under measurement. So I can tell you with some degree of certainty, 95% confidence interval, you end up modifying about 5 to 15% of a typical shared baseline to meet the needs of an individual patient. Now, a way to think about this, what they really are very efficient tools for measuring variation within a process. The most efficient we've ever found. Anytime somebody varies, we feed the data back. If we have statistically meaningful numbers, we do it at a group level, I mean statistically. You can even use it, though, on very, very unusual, rare cases. We first discovered it, in fact, with management of acute respiratory distress syndrome in our ICUs with ventilators, where you'd apply it one case at a time, one decision at a time, and it worked. We've generalized it on a pretty broad scale with some very good impact. It's interesting. It's more important to do it the same than that you do it right, in the sense that there's a myriad of opinions, and that's right description, opinions, in my experience, level four evidence, pure anecdotal, about what's right. If you can get people to do it the same, though, well, your error rates tend to fall, your costs fall. But most important, you can apply a philosophy of science to create a learning lab where you can systematically improve. Variation then leading to learning, leading to demonstrated improvement is the idea behind it. Now, the fact is, one of the reasons that we tie into Dartmouth so well, our different approach seemed to validate what they were finding on a broad scale. Of course, the difference with ours is we were taking that information and using it to show demonstrated improvements in care. Just to highlight one last problem, though, to wrap this up, real project, it happened at our little level 5, community level, American Fork Hospital, beautiful little hospital, a young, growing community, very large birthing service. Well, occasionally in that birthing service, they'll have newborns who are technically not small premature infants. They have at least 33 weeks gestational age. Full term, of course, is 40 weeks. But they go on to develop respiratory distress syndrome anyway. RDS, immature lungs, the alveoli collapse. The child can't oxygenate properly. Now, traditionally, the way that we've treated these kids, we would transfer them up the road just 10 miles to Utah Valley Regional Medical Center, that big tertiary, stick them in the newborn ICU on mechanical ventilation. Kind of tough love, but they do fairly well. They pretty much all survive, and more than that, normal results. Well, the folks at American Fork, working with our neonatologist from Utah Valley, had a bright idea, a well-developed, well-proven technology in newborns, nasal continuous positive airway pressure, nasal CPAP, to prevent alveolar collapse, perhaps with some oxygen and surfactant. We deployed it in a trial. About 110 of these kids per year at American Fork. We watched our transport rate decline from 78% transferred to the newborn ICU on mechanical ventilation to 18%. So about 65 kids per year. What I've shown you in the table below is the actual cost impact on Intermountain. I've expressed it as net operating income, margins. This is the thing that actually drives financial behavior within real care delivery.
Second, I believe there is clearly waste in healthcare, at least when it's reviewed retrospectively, and that there are enormous opportunities for improvements. And I agree that there is significant unexplained variations in discretionary services, and it's our job as a profession to understand that and to improve them. I agree with Dr. James 1,000%. Now, I actually managed 80,000 capitated lives in the 1990s, and during the time that I was doing kidney transplants, almost all of our procedures were under bundled payments. So we actually in California have a fairly extensive experience with all of these proposals, and I'm completely in favor of capitation and bundled payments to incentivize accountable physician and hospital organizations. But I don't think we should underestimate the challenge to translating those methods to actually lowering costs, and unfortunately, I don't think there's an easy way out of the current dilemma. Let me see if I can advance the slide. And actually, in 1999, this is a scanned op-ed piece that I did for the Los Angeles Times, where I say that California now has thousands of physicians who have stepped forward and expressed their willingness to be held accountable and to be part of systems of care. Policies should be examined through the prism of whether they enhance and offer incentives to the continued development of physician groups, which I think are absolutely essential to any of the kinds of forward moving that we're talking about this afternoon. So let me just then touch, so with that having been said, that's where I'm coming from in relation to this, I think reform of some form or another is absolutely essential. But now let me talk just a moment about geographic variation in general, and we've touched on all of these points earlier this in the conversations today about prices, the role of health status, et cetera. I think that I would agree. I think the interchange with Dr. Pardis at the question and answers of the first session pretty well dealt with the necessity for considering these factors in a totality if we're going to look at geographic variation at the large region level. And I think for certain, my read of the literature and my own personal experience of dealing with patients and their families is that when you're dealing with end-of-life questions, patient preferences do matter and would have to be part of that dialogue. But rather than rehash what we talked about this morning or earlier in the session, I think it's pretty clear also that we've learned that it may be the case that geographic regions or states aren't the best unit of measurement because they mask important intra-regional differences. And let me just illustrate that by some of the work that we've looked at here in Los Angeles. So here is Los Angeles County with over 10 million population. I think it's larger than just about, it's maybe would be the fifth largest state in the country if it was its own state. So it's larger than many of the Midwest and upper Midwest states. And you can see, however, that it's not a uniform, homogeneous area. That embedded in it is a core of over 2 million people with a per capita income in 2007 that was equal to 100% of the federal poverty level, which is a pretty extraordinary urban poverty concentration. And you can see that compared with the 8 million of the rest of Los Angeles County, or almost 8 million, which has less than 3% of the population at less than 100% poverty level. Well, let me just demonstrate the impact of that when we look at hospital utilization. Now, these are Medicare hospital days per 1,000 Medicare enrollees, and if you compare L.A. County overall to Minnesota, which is on the left hand of the slide, it's about 20% difference, which is in line with what we saw on the Dartmouth maps and the other maps that we've been shown. But on the right hand of that slide, you can see the impact of the hospital utilization in that urban poverty core. And while it doesn't explain all the difference with LA County, the rest of LA County is still somewhat higher than Minnesota, it explains a fairly large chunk of it. And I won't quibble the point about whether poverty explains all, a lot, a little, or otherwise. It certainly suggests that Dr. Fisher is correct that when he states that the value index may not be the best idea because you would harm both the presumably good providers and the presumably less efficient providers. And in the case of a region like Los Angeles County, you would not be able to discern that, in fact, embedded in that are good providers who are not necessarily by the other methodology perceived of as good providers. So this seems to be an important consideration in the whole geographic variation. Now, the other thing that I believe we learned, and this came up a little bit in the question and answer session, but the data to me looks pretty pretty difficult to explain, which is that Medicare spending doesn't correlate with overall health spending, and there's some fairly significant data on that. And here's going all the way back to 2000, and I think this was from 2006. I'm sorry, I don't have the date on the slide, but each one of the dots on the slide is a U.S. state, and on the x-axis is the per capita total healthcare spending, and on the y-axis is the Medicare per cap per enrollee spending. And you can see while there is a slight correlation upward, it really looks quite like a scattergram. But if we take even one more example, and again, this is a local one for us in Los Angeles, where we look at hospital days per thousand, and therefore this would not be impacted by prices, or per capita hospital spending, and both of these are from the Kaiser Healthcare Foundation statehealthfacts.org, which is on the slide, you can see that, in fact, hospital utilization in Los Angeles County, when you take all spending, is actually, if you were using this as a measure of efficiency, Los Angeles County would look to be significantly more efficient than Minnesota. So there was also an article that appeared just recently in Health Affairs where in the discussion this phenomenon was labeled, quote, the strange case of the Dartmouth-Atlas Reimbursement Index, end quote. This article was about commercial insurance benefits plans, and these authors hypothesized that if the provider practice style is driving the variation seen in Medicare spending, that it should be similar in the private sector. And they discovered that when the Dartmouth-Atlas Reimbursement Index was entered with the Geographic Practice Cost Index, that is the commercial index, it was statistically significant, but with a negative coefficient. My conclusion was it's a fair testament to the power of belief that it's become so widely understood that the Medicare end-of-life data represents overall regional or hospital healthcare delivery efficiency that when it turns out there are some gaps in that, it's declared a paradox. So like Dr. Fisher said earlier, it seems to me it would be very bad policy to reallocate Medicare money from one state to another on the basis of geographic variation that's presumed to be based on efficiency of providers, where the variation may or may not be caused by inefficient providers, but may actually be based on other factors that we're not able to measure perfectly well with the methodologies that we have. And the final piece on this is we know from numerous health economists that as you get to larger and larger units of measurement, the wealth of the community becomes an overwhelming factor in health resource utilization. Now, if we were to look at what if we were to use or attempt to look at other methods of efficiency measurements, what options are there available to us? And there actually now is some science on this. And the statements on this slide are from the AHA, American College of Cardiology guidelines on efficiency measurement, and frankly borrowed a little bit from the NQF on their notion about how to measure quality. And given that efficiency is a measure both of cost and quality, these seem to be relevant metrics or approaches. And the conclusions there are that you must have a evidence-based risk adjustment for factors known to affect the metrics that are present at the start of care. That information produced by the measure ought to be useful for informing quality improvement initiatives. The quality and cost are integrated, that there's proper attribution of the measure, and that whatever we would do to improve cost or incentivize improvement in cost, that we would be relatively certain that it doesn't reduce quality. And the question I posed is, would Medicare death cases meet these scientific standards, and my assessment and that of several others would suggest that these would not be, this would not be the efficiency measure that you might start with if you were going to try to create a metric at the hospital or provider-based level. I might parenthetically add, as although I've said that this isn't useful for quality improvement, I actually think that they are, because we've been very, our group has been very inspired by some of the data around end of life, which has suggested that there are significant opportunities for improvement there, but it's not clear that the measurement is useful at a local level to be used in the way, for example, that Dr. James described. So we took the Dartmouth Atlas data that came out about 5 years ago and were quite frankly inspired by it. Dr. Winberg came and made a presentation to our University of California CEOs of the hospitals and the chief medical officers, and we looked at that with somewhat of alarm. It was not, we didn't look good. There was variation that, frankly, we certainly couldn't explain, and we felt compelled to do the thing that we think we know how to do well, which is actually to mobilize people in an academic environment to study the matter at hand in some degree of detail. So we had several goals in setting up a UC-wide consortium, and the UC-wide, I'll show you who those members are in a moment, but we wanted to carefully analyze variation, not just to do it, not just to refute or to be argumentative in the debate, but to actually, because we were certain actually that we would, no matter how well we carefully analyzed it, that we would find variation the same way everybody else has found variation, and that we would use that then and the measurement methodology to identify and tee up implementation projects to actually reduce variation. And reducing variation, we believe, lowering cost and improving quality. And the final goal of the consortium, which I think is not unimportant and has not come up yet in the conversation, is that we believe that a collaboration between the outcomes researchers community and clinician leadership was really essential to be able to effectively both produce this kind of information and to intervene on it. So let me show you the project team. Dr. Mike Ong, who was one of our well-trained Robert Wood Johnson scholars, who's now a general internist and a hospitalist, was the PI of the entire group, and you can see the research side from UC Davis, UC Irvine, UCLA, UC San Diego, UC San Francisco, and we were fortunate to have Cedars-Sinai Medical Center participate with this group, Cedars-Sinai being a very close affiliate of UCLA and another large academic medical center. So these six hospitals comprised the group. The study design that we took all Medicare patients over the age of 65 with a primary diagnosis of congestive heart failure, and this is one way in which we differed from the previous work, the Dartmouth work, and things that we've heard about, in that we felt very strongly that we needed a cohort that we could identify and that would be an apples-to-apples comparison across the six participating hospitals. We picked the same time period that the Dartmouth group had used, only for consistency's sake. There were 7,301 patients, of whom 1,373 had died during that time period. So, again, one difference with the Dartmouth work and others' work around end of life was that we felt it was important, in fact, to have a looking forward and a looking back cohort. We did a number of risk-adjusting exercises, both with regard to demographics and comorbidities, and we elected to exclude transplants and transfers because we believed that those two patient sets were hard to call out based on other risk factors that we had, and we believed that we know for a fact that they significantly skew the data. And in fact, we did some chart review, although I'm not going to share any of that today with you, but the chart review actually got into questions of, did it appear to make any difference whether hospitalists were involved in the care or whether the patients were managed by cardiologists? and that was what we did some of the chart review, and we looked at 180-day cost and mortality. So, and here's the paper which was published at the end of last year in Circulation, and the authors of that paper. So here's the starting point for the data. Here were just one sample of ICU days for all death Medicare patients in the last 2 years of life, and the relative performance is on the y-axis, and each of the bars is one of the six centers in the study. I will tell you that bar 3 is UCLA and bar 5 was UCSF. And in fact, it was that difference that got both UCLA and UCSF's attention in a very significant way. And it was very interesting because the hospital director at UCSF had actually spent a significant amount of time at UCLA in senior management of the hospital and was at somewhat of a loss to explain how, in fact, his hospital looked so good in this. It's a testament to sort of the power of investigation that he was one of the major proponents of our doing this study, even though he could have very easily said, "Hey, we look great. Leave us alone. Thank you very much. We'll rest on our laurels here." So now here is the total hospital days in the last 6 months of life in the UC study that I've described for you, looking at Medicare patients and a primary diagnosis of congestive heart failure. And you can see that there is a pretty substantial reduction in the amount of variation, although hospital 6 does have a somewhat more than twofold relative performance over hospital 4, which had the lowest total hospital days in the cohort when looking at patients who died. The next slide has on the left the same data that you saw on the previous slide, which is total hospital days in the last 6 months of life, and now on the right hand of the slide is total hospital days for all patients, so those who lived and those that died. And you can see that the five bars on the left part of that graph cluster very tightly around 1.0. Hospital 6 is still somewhat on the higher side of utilization, slightly less than twice the other five centers. But what we did have, because this was not just a looking back at patients who had died, we did get from Medicare the 180-day all-cause mortality from those original cohorts, and frankly, we were quite surprised that there was this kind of outcome where there was about a 9% difference between the lowest mortality hospital and the highest mortality hospital. And we were equally surprised that the lowest mortality hospital was Hospital 6 that had the almost twofold difference. Now, this would then seem to be at least one example of where spending more is at least related to having better outcomes, although we would not begin to try to posit that there's a causal relationship here. We know no more about that than we know from some of the other geographic studies that we've been talking about today as to whether or not these are causal relationships. But these are what the outcomes are, and it would draw one to the conclusion that, in fact, if you were drawing however, an efficiency comparison, that in point of fact, hospitals number 3 and 4 would appear to be the most efficient. But this is a somewhat stylized graph because all I did here was take the relative performance of cost and the relative performance in quality and simply divided them, and you get this kind of graph. What we don't know is what the value system is in relationship to having a 17% survival or mortality rate versus a 26% versus the cost. There are some rather strong ethical ambiguities in relationship to the statement that, in fact, the most efficient hospital in this study was Hospital 4. Points out that I think we just don't really know precisely how we would talk about efficiency once we have successfully parsed out the questions about cost
and about questions about outcomes. Now, we've expanded the work in a pretty significant way, working with AAMC and the University Health System Consortium to study variation, and you can see that we have an additional ten hospitals, academic systems that are participating with the core UC group, and with the goal of doing this kind of analysis, but more importantly, as I mentioned earlier, doing the kind of intervention studies that would improve efficiency, that is to say lower cost and improve outcomes. Our goal here would actually be to not just do something that we can prove works in one or two or three academic medical centers, but in fact it would be scalable and widely applicable across the entire country. And additionally, we are very close to getting a grant to do end-of-life interventions to reduce unnecessary, or what we hope will be identified as unnecessary, intensive care unit admissions and to improve the palliative care for dying patients. So this is the important next steps that we have. So the observations that I would make is that healthcare cost is an important component of healthcare policy. That seems like a truism, but basically for the last 10 years, it really hasn't been much on the radar screen. It was heavily on the radar screen in the 1990s. It has, to some extent, fallen off the radar screen. I think it's back on the radar screen. However, we don't have really a societal consensus about what we actually do need to bend the healthcare cost curve, and that there's a societal acceptance of those elements that would be really necessary to do that. The second point is that to compare efficiencies, we really need to have well-defined cohorts. Doing these studies, at least in the way that we think is correct and thoughtful, and would have good risk adjustment, and that the outcomes and measurements must be done at an accountable level. A corollary to that is I think it's extremely unlikely that just like quality measurements, I doubt very seriously that there will be a single roll-up measure of efficiency. I think it's highly probable that, for example, we would find that UCLA is substantially more efficient in some area than UCSF, and I think it's equally probable that we would find some area where UCSF is demonstrated to be substantially more efficient than UCLA, and the idea that there's some single index that's going to rank hospitals seems to be, it certainly hasn't been the case in the quality world. I think it's extremely unlikely that it's going to be present in the efficiency measurement at even the hospital level. The next observation that I have to before I conclude is that to do the work well is expensive, and that the funding is in short supply. The entire AHRQ budget is about 1% of the NIH budget, so it really isn't surprised that this kind of work has been difficult to get off the ground. I'm going to quote from a paper, and then I'll tell you what the quote is from. But the quote goes, today, this was in 2008, but it's no different now, there is virtually no clinical research that focuses on variation in care intensity. The nation needs a crash program to transform the management of chronic illness to a rational system. Detailed specification of the clinical pathways for managing chronic illness and validation of those pathways through outcomes research is necessary before we can pay for performance on the basis of cost-effectiveness and efficiency, end quote. And that's from the 2008 Dartmouth Atlas, which I would agree with 1,000%. The corollary to point number three on my slide is that I really believe that the collaboration between outcomes researchers and clinical leadership is essential. Our outcomes collaborators understand the statistical methodology and the study design and in ways that Brent James perhaps excluded, many of us are not familiar with. By the same token, many of the people doing outcomes research need access to hospital-level data, and without the collaboration with the clinical leadership in an organization, it's very difficult for them to get access to. And finally, my last observation is I think that geographic variation in Medicare spending isn't a good measure of efficiency. We've learned a lot from it. I believe it may have the ability to continue to point us in some right directions, but that the methodology is works at a large level. But to really get the kind of answers that we need the sort of validation studies like what we've done at UC. Further, unfortunately, and I think it's really been an unfortunate consequence, that the science around geographic variation became rather politicized, and that in a way the continued focus on it is a diversion from the essential tasks, where I agree with Dr. Fisher 100% about figuring out how we move forward from here together. And I also agree with him that I think there's substantial more agreement about how that could go than there is disagreement. I would say parenthetically that the experience in California of organized medical groups in 1999, 25% of all the physicians who practiced in California were part of an accountable healthcare organization. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the state in the union that had the lowest rate of increase of healthcare spending from 1991 to 2004 was California. But those physician groups, it took many, many years to convert fee-for-service doctors to working in some kind of environment that was accountable. The vast majority of doctors throughout the country practice in those kinds of organizations, and I, again, don't think we should minimize the effort that it's going to take to create the kind of accountable healthcare organizations that Dr. Fisher and I agree ought to be the way in which we go about improving both cost and quality of healthcare in the United States. And I think that's my concluding remark.
Well, thank you very much. We have a little bit behind, but we're doing fine time-wise. A couple minutes for questions, so if we could find out who has a question, that'd be great.
The floor is now open for questions. To ask a question, press star 1 now. Again, that is star 1 to ask a question. Our first question comes from Nancy Foster.
Thanks. Dr. Rosenthal, would you say a little bit more about this notion that the outcomes researchers and the clinical leadership in hospitals have to be more closely aligned, that they each have valuable things they need from each other, and that will help us move this ball forward? I'm particularly concerned as we think about the vast number of hospitals across the country who are not usually actively engaged in that kind of research. How do we make that happen, and is it important that we have that kind of link for virtually every hospital in the country in order to have the kind of improvement you're talking about?
Well, that's a great question, and I think Dr. Pardis and his question in one of the earlier sessions hinted at sort of the same thing. It's fine for 15 academic medical centers to come together who do have these resources and do have individuals committed to this kind of cost analysis and people capable of doing health policy research. I think what we have to figure out is how to have regional collaboratives that would bring these same resources to bear for all kinds of hospitals. And it would seem to me organizations like the AHA would be great conveners of such collaboratives. We've certainly seen evidence where, and the classic one, of course, is the New England Cardiac Surgery Group, where people got together from multiple hospitals to do this kind of work. And in those settings, I think you could bring together people with the statistical and design expertise to guide the studies and collaborate in the studies that would provide that kind of expertise where, as you say, the average community hospital may not have any such people involved in helping them do it. I think to do this, it is, and where we've agreed with the Dartmouth, every paper that I've read from Dartmouth over the 20 years that I've been referring to their work, almost every discussion of in their paper concludes with almost a begging or a plea for money and people to study the work and come up with the answers. And so I do think, and they basically begged academic medical centers to take on that task. And I think academic medical centers, after all these many years, have perhaps finally heard the message and are going to take it on. And I do think the academic medical centers do have a special obligation to take this kind of work on. But the community hospital collaboratives, the collaboratives that could be organized by organizations like AHA at the state level and local level are another avenue to carry out that kind of work.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have another question from Dr. Herbert Pardon.
I just want to first compliment the organizers because the presentations are superb. And I just want to underscore what Tom said. I think the politicization of this is unfortunate. And the more we have substantive presentations as we're having today and try to think together as to how to move it forward, the better. I also want to feel that your comments, Tom, at least make me resonate to the notion that the impact of poverty can't be trivialized. It is a consequential factor, and I think the main point is that there are a lot of factors. And also, the point made before about the fact you've got to be very careful, I guess Elliot did this, with regard to looking at a region in aggregate, because you can have good and bad in the region, and you don't want to punish the good and reward the bad. But I do want to come back to one question related to what you said, Tom. If you could give ARC X number of additional dollars, could you make some comments about the kind of studies you'd want to fund or encourage through that mechanism?
Well, thank you, Herb, and thanks for the nice comments. I appreciate it. It was shocking to me when I actually looked at the numbers side by side of how poorly AHRQ is funded. And a number of people have made observations that, well, maybe there should be some other entity that would take on sort of this comparative effectiveness work. So I don't know what the number is, but I think it's certainly well north of where it is today. And I think the kind of work that they should fund, and this is a little self-serving, but I think it's they should fund the kinds of interventions that the AAMC is proposing to do with a large number of centers looking at how to actually intervene and come up with better ways of delivering care. Medicare had some demonstration projects, but some of them involved assumption of risk that many organizations weren't prepared to take on, and I think that and therefore organizations couldn't afford a negative answer. So I think that those are that's the kind of work. What is the best way to do heart failure care? What is the proper role for rehabilitation services, home, hospice, other kinds of interventions? Can we get structured materials to people who appear to be at the end of life so that they can make good decisions about their end-of-life care? And I think that it isn't exactly comparative effectiveness in the way it's been described early on with let's demonstrate that this drug works better than that drug. This literally would be the work that says, this way of delivering chronic care is better than that way of delivering chronic care, and it's scalable and transferable throughout the country. So that would be the kind of thing I would strongly endorse. And yet, so I would hope that part of the reform effort is to include that funding. It seemed to me incredibly unfortunate that it got attached to, again, other politicized aspects of the thing, which are detrimental to moving the ball forward the way I think it should be. Herb, did that answer your question?
Thank you very much, Tom.
We have time for one more question.
Yes.
Our next question comes from Kirk Norris.
Scott, I'm not sure if the other panelists are still on, but there seems to be uniformity of opinion, kind of rallying around ACOs. I'm sitting here trying to kind of distinguish in my own mind based on the policy discussions on health reform and other materials that have been out on ACOs. What are we really talking about here as distinguished from the old concept of focusing on centers for excellence and, maybe a stronger reinforcement of primary care or community care? It's almost like we're begging for a solution which may, by default, be evolving on its own, and I kind of like to have the panelists reflect on that a little bit.
I'm with you, Kirk. I don't know who's still on, but to the extent anyone's listening, please chime in.
Well, I'm still on, and I'll take a crack at it. I mean, I've asked the question over and over of whether sort of medical homes, in fact, I asked our chair of family medicine the other day, you know, how does it differ from multi-specialty group practice in California in the 1990s that had a heavy component of primary care, and he thought for quite a while, and at the end I don't think really came up with any substantial difference. So I think that when we're talking about accountable healthcare organizations, we probably are talking, and particularly, look, there are clear examples of places like the Mayo Clinic and Geisinger and other that are fully existing accountable organizations, could assume some level of risk today. The question is going to be, if that's going to be a national policy, how do you get the 95% of the physicians who don't practice in any kind of accountable organization into something? And that's what took about 10 years in California. And the incentives to do that were, in fact, channeling of patients and capitation. And unfortunately, I don't know how to get around the question that Caroline posed earlier. There was an element of, let's call it what it was, coercion in doing that, and it imploded towards the end of the 90s. I think until there's a societal agreement and commitment that we have to bend the healthcare curve, and it isn't going to be sufficient for some policy people who are sort of inside the beltway kind of doing it. It's got to be rank and file physicians, and it's got to be rank and file population, and particularly the middle class. Because if they don't go along with what this means, it seems to me doomed to repeat the exact experience of the 1990s. Having said that, I think if capitation is done right and you get physicians in IPAs and you have multi-specialty group practices and that they're aligned with hospitals, you can have high quality and reduce cost.
Thank you. Is anyone else still on the line?
We have another question from Dr. Herbert Pardis.
Well, to be honest, if it wouldn't be too out of line, ask Herb if he could hold that question, because I really would. We're about 20 minutes behind. I wonder if we couldn't get our next couple speakers in and then open it up for more questions. Would that be okay?
That's fine.
Okay, thank you. Well, with that, I'd like to thank Dr. Rosen. Thank you all very much for your comments. Hopefully you can stick with us. You're more than welcome. And turn it over to Nancy again to introduce our next speaker.
Thank you again, Scott. I appreciate that. Well, for much of the day today, we've been talking about Medicare data, but alluding to the fact that we want to know much more about other payer data as well. Much of the work that exists in the published literature is really based on Medicare data, and since the work of this task force, at least as asked by the AHA board, the work of this task force is to look very broadly at all of these issues, it's important that we have some additional perspectives, which is why we've asked Dr. Korn to come and share with us any insights he can bring from analysis of the Blue Cross Blue Shield data. Dr. Alan Korn, whom I've had the privilege of knowing as he sits on the Hospital Quality Alliance, the HQA, as a member of that group, is the Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer of Blue Cross Blue Shield Association. He oversees the Technology Evaluation Center, which is an independent and applied health services research organization using evidence-based methodology for the assessment of clinical techniques and technologies. Dr. Korn received a Bachelor of Science and Medical degree from Tufts. He completed his internship and internal medicine residency at Chicago Wesley Memorial Hospital and at the Mayo Clinic. And today, Dr. Korn is really going to share new research, unpublished research, on variation within the privately insured population. We're delighted that he could join us and provide these insights. Alan?
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I thank you all. In response to a previous comment about how do we put ARC in its appropriate place, my recommendation has always been to make the NIH a division of ARC. Unfortunately, that recommendation isn't going anywhere, but I think it could solve a lot of our problems. What I'm going to do today is go very quickly through a bunch of slides and then leave you with some provocative thoughts, because that's sort of what I do for a living. The question I was asked to answer is, does the private sector have the kind of data that is comparable to that which is used by the Dartmouth Atlas and Medicare? And then move on to what I think is a far more meaningful way to deal with quality. So let me answer your question. I'll start with a very high level and go very quickly through this. And when I get to the last slide, I think we're going to have a whole lot to talk about. Yes, we now have these data. We have built an enormous warehouse of data that we internally refer to as Blue Health Intelligence. It goes back for a long time, and it contains everything we know about our members. Obviously, the claims are there. If we have pharmacy adherence data, it's there. If we have lab data and we can capture it, it's there. And it's about 60 million members, on its way fairly soon to being everybody, which is about 100 million members. So we're going to look at what these data show us, but I then want to move very quickly beyond it. So we can find out, for example, at a very high level, things like population measures such as this. And the data that I'm going to show you isn't important in and of itself. Blue Health Intelligence is a work in progress, which will be, it'll actually never be finished, but I mean, phase one and the total build out will probably be ready with all of its data elements in it later this year. But we had enough in there to test it and see if it worked. And so let me show you again what I mean. We can look at variation. We used arthroscopy here, and we can adjust it for age, gender, industry type, that is, who our customers are and what the diagnoses are, and show significant differences geographically. And we can take that down to a local level as well. So these data are there, and within a very short period of time, we can get down to the same level that Elliot and others have been using with the Medicare data, and actually, I hope, sort of compare, you know, site by site, private sector versus public claims data, and come to some conclusion as to whether or not it's the same or different. Incidentally, I do know that Blue Cross Blue Shield of Texas is soon to complete an analysis of its own experience with claims from McAllen and elsewhere in that state. And although it is not yet available, it will shortly be available, and I would not be at all surprised if our experience was quite different from that that was noted by Medicare. We'll find out. And, of course, when that's available, I'm certain you all know about it in short order. Let me then leap to where I think we have far better and more meaningful information to use. We put together a Centers of Excellence program that is somewhat unique in that it didn't use a single medical claim. We surveyed America's hospitals and their medical staffs with respect to the both processes and outcomes of care to find out who was really doing well in the areas that we're looking at this time. And what's unique about it is that when you serve 100 million people, it isn't realistic to expect that 10% of America's hospitals can service that number of people. So when an application comes in and it doesn't quite reach the level of performance that would warrant designation as Blue Distinction, we send the application back with the answer sheet so that in the next cycle, that institution can improve, and our hope is that the level of care rises universally across the country, which is really the goal. I mean, if you think about it, it sounds very nice to be called a center of excellence, but if it's a small number of institutions, what does that make everybody else? You know, a center of what? Mediocrity or worse? And to us, that's not a solution to the quality or cost problem. And so as we look at how this plays out, we have such centers for bariatric surgery, cardiovascular surgical procedures, rare and complex cancers. We just announced, interestingly enough, hip and knee replacement and spine surgery centers, and that was an interesting exercise since there are no formal criteria out there, but using appropriate organizations and people, we were able to actually find them that were found to be quite credible. and finally solid cancers. Well, that's fine, and that's all well and good, and we have a number of them all together now, about 13 or 14 institutions in various designations, some with multiple designations. And so we can demonstrate that we can do what Elliot can do, and hopefully can do it together very soon when this thing is all built. But because of what you've heard from previous speakers, the issue is, so what? And so what I find truly compelling is, all of them superimposed. Here are some of the data, by the way, and there are compelling differences between institutions who make the cut and institutions who don't. So, I don't want to dwell on this, but the question was, can we find variation across the country in the private sector? And I think I've at least shown you a number of examples of why the answer to that is sure. But here's the compelling story here that I want to spend a minute on. We recently did a joint replacement Centers of Excellence program, and these institutions are sent survey instruments that contain information about processes and outcomes of care, focused not only on the specialty procedure that is of interest, but on some rather significant safety measures within the institution as well. And of the 835 institutions who actually applied for such designation, little less than half made it. Look at the variation in what it is that, this is not claims data. This is what these physicians and hospitals are telling us they do. Now that's enormous variation and a source of concern for me as a potential patient, and also for me as someone who sort of oversees how we contract for care for the 100 million people that we cover. And so as I reflect on these data, you know, it occurs to me that there may be other utilities. What, for example, might the response of a medical specialty certification board be to these data? Would there be an opportunity to use the maintenance of certification process to sort of specifically target the kinds of modules that would be required on an annual basis to the deficiencies that are apparent here? I think it's inappropriate to think that the way a hospital contracts or is paid for care is going to solve these problems. I also think that we need to understand that accountable care organizations are wonderful where they can exist. But where they can't exist, I think we need to think long and hard about accountable clinicians or accountable clinical teams, such as those that would be created by an individual patient and then bundled under a system similar to, for example, Prometheus. And in rural Kansas, you could probably do that. I don't think you'd create a true accountable care organization. And so if we think about how a patient would create his or her own accountable care team, and we took data such as these, which are from the very institutions that they would access, and began to work collaboratively with those who might impact the way physicians would practice, who could target practice improvement modules to the areas that really needed improvement, we actually might see a significant movement in both the quality and cost needles that we have yet to see over the past decade or so, and particularly in the safety needle, which is just frustratingly stuck. So, yes, we have the claims data. We also are created at just, you know how expensive this is, this database to actually massage, and I think that's important. I think what we learn, however, from direct data fed to us by those who provide care is also very useful and may even have a higher utility. And so I'll just conclude here, if I can, by suggesting there's been little improvement, that's a typo, in the safety of healthcare over the past 10 years or so. It's truly unacceptable. And quite frankly, our real vision is in a non-confrontational, non-adversarial way to fix this. And while we wait for accountable care organizations to develop in downstate Illinois, never mind Chicago, we could probably create them there, anywhere in upstate New York, or in most of America, we can't wait. And so we would like to deal with this variation using every tool at our disposal, and particularly get to those institutions who have the respect of clinicians, and their certifying boards certainly are among those, and in a supportive and a non-punitive way begin to engage with our clinicians to support their participation in programs that have improved both the safety and quality of care. And I want to make sure that Herb has a chance to ask his question, so I'm going to stop here and see if there are any comments.
Thank you. Appreciate that, and I guess we will open the floor for questions.
Thank you. The floor is now open for questions. Please press star 1 now to ask a question. Again, that is the star key followed by the 1 key now to ask a question. The first question comes from Joe Swedish. Joe Swedish at Trinity Health, you may ask your question.
Thank you. Just a quick question regarding your very last statement about there being little variation in the improvement in safety, healthcare. Is that that seems counterintuitive given all the focus that we've placed upon this in the industry for the past decade? I wonder if you could comment on that finding a little more.
There has been a great deal of attention. We, for example, at the association, funded the 5 Million Lives campaign that Don Berwick undertook, last year and the year before. And we found a lot of interest and engagement. But we also found that it was seen as a project. And once we got to the end of that campaign and Don moved on to the next, hospitals again moved on to other issues, and there wasn't a cultural change, a redefinition of work, or people within most institutions who understood how to maintain a significant clinical innovation across many departments with a medical staff over whom there was really no direct control, and so there was slippage. And so when we look at overall measures of hospital safety, there has been really very little change over that period of time. And so the Blues are looking again, and we try to do this very quietly. We don't want this to be about us. It has to be about providing hospitals with the tools and, most importantly, the people who at or just below the C-suite level can be empowered to not only implement but manage and sustain the kinds of changes that are going to be necessary to create a dependable culture of safety. And so it's just a challenge. Hospitals are among the most complicated organizations on earth. You all know why more than others. Your boards are not experts in all of the issues that hospitals confront, and you have that to deal with. So it's been a tough slog, and we would like to find ways to accelerate the process that leads to a true culture of safety within institutions. And so that's been one of the, well, that's the primary goal of our Blue Cross and Blue Shield clinicians for the next couple or 3 years. And I'm sure many of you will be hearing from us, and if any of you are CEOs, you'll probably be hearing from Blue Cross and Blue Shield CEOs, who I think will extend their hand and say, how do we do this together? At least that's our goal. So that's the basis of this opinion. The data are also quite compelling. We haven't seen a big change.
Thank you. Do we have other questions?
I'm showing no more questions at this time. Actually, Michael Rock from the Mayo Clinic has a question.
Thank you very much, Alan. I enjoyed that. I've enjoyed all the presentations actually this afternoon, and this is less a question than an observation. I was very intrigued to see that you were trying to associate the potential increase in safety and quality within our enterprise or within our organizations and match that to the maintenance of certification. I don't know whether you're aware of the fact that one of my colleagues, an orthopedic surgeon in our department who is in charge of CME for Mayo Foundation, has actually approached a number of the licensing organizations across the country to allow for quality and safety initiatives to meet the criteria for CME credits. And he's met a tremendous amount of, he's been extremely well received, and a number of the independent subspecialty organizations are now beginning to adopt this to afford the opportunity for healthcare organizations and hospitals specifically to coordinate with their physician counterparts patient safety and quality initiatives that allow the physicians to continue to clinically practice in their environment without having to go to some remote site to gain those CME credits. And as I understand it from Dick Berger, who is the architect from our institution, this is gaining a lot of traction and is gaining a lot of reception in as many subspecialty disciplines.
I'll contact you offline next week. We share this passion, and I think we'd be more effective together than independently.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Hey, Mike, this is Scott. That's a great point. I had not heard that, but that really catches my attention, too. That would be terrific. Any other questions?
Yes, we have a question from Dan Sisto.
Yes, I guess it's just an observation on the last comment still, going back to the question about how accurate a conclusion that is. I just want to say from, and I don't have any data to back it up, but from personal observation of my own membership and being in enough national forums with AHA, I just see a dramatic change in the culture, the attitude, the mindsets of trustees and of CEOs everywhere. And I find, while the point is valid about how much further the road is ahead, to discredit and by saying there hasn't been any improvement in 10 years, all of the research, the comparative studies, the IHI initiative, the public reporting, the CMS efforts, the linkage of quality, the private insurance companies, private sector efforts. We see it all over, growing with the pay-for-performance that's coming out of voluntary efforts between hospitals and payers. I just find it astonishing. I mean, I know you said you wanted to be provocative. This is a group that deals with provocation all the time, so it's not like we need to be an impetus. But I don't think anything you presented beforehand justified the conclusion, except in the areas where you mentioned it. But I take a look at the infection control efforts in New York State. I don't think constructive to have a conclusion that effectively discounts the work that's been done and the commitment that's being made, the improvements that are in fact ongoing. Because it just says, in effect, well, all of that didn't matter, so we must be doing the wrong stuff if none of it mattered. Thanks.
All of that does matter, and we acknowledge that there are now more than 200 or perhaps even 300 hospitals who go through an annual cycle with no ventilator-associated infections, and we know in Michigan the impact of Peter Protogo's program on central line infections, and we salute you. There are thousands of hospitals in the United States that we contract with and deal with. And so we have a long way to go. And I don't mean to imply that hospitals, that a number of hospitals haven't made extraordinary strides. But, America's hospitals have a great big footprint. And so my point in saying this is not to be pejorative, but to say that, here's a statement. I mean, we know for past decade or so that there has been an issue, and we need to reflect on that. When asked, I've asked if any CEO of a major or a significant institution in the market area has ever approached the CEO of Blue Cross and Blue Shield Plan, and we're always a significant player in the market, and said, we do have some issues that we'd love to tackle. This is what we need to succeed. This is the kind of help that we'd like Blue Cross to provide. Would you help us? And to my knowledge, that question's never been asked. And so what we're going to suggest to our CEOs is that they ask the question. But they'd also be very receptive to an invitation. We're not going to solve this problem by pointing fingers at one another. And it's simply not acceptable for us to say, well, we have 3,000 hospitals that just aren't good enough.
Our members have to go to those hospitals. And we want to do everything we can to help them get to the level that the institutions you described have already achieved. So that's the purpose of this, and we're committed to that very deeply over the next several years. This is not a six-month campaign, and then we move on. So I'm glad you raised that point.
Thank you. Are we out of questions?
We have two more questions.
Okay, great. So we'll take the two, and then we'll move to the final speaker.
Okay. We have a question from Dr. Pardis.
Alan?
Yes, sir.
I just want to tell you how happy I am to hear your voice. Appreciate your provocation. Completely agree with Dan Sisto that you overstated the case. But since you said you're looking for a large CEO hospital to invite you, you're invited. I'd love to sit down and talk with you. I think it's the right spirit that's coming out of this, which is to press for collaboration between all of us to make it better.
We'll do it.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Lauren Massa.
Hi, this is Lori Massa in Minnesota. I just wanted to share with Dr. Korn that, in fact, we did go to the Blue Cross Blue Shield plan here in Minnesota for support when we put in our adverse events reporting law and actually got some grant funding from them to develop our patient registry. So I think there are some examples of hospitals working with Blue Cross and other payers to really get at the patient safety issue.
Glad to hear it. Thank you.
We did have one additional question from Jim Castle.
We're not letting Castle talk at all. That's a big mistake.
Well, I just wanted to support the notion that a half a dozen years ago in Ohio, we approached the largest Blue Cross provider and asked that they sit down with us and work with the other insurance companies to pool their information, and we were told absolutely not. It's a competitive advantage for Blue Cross to have this information, and so we were rejected in an effort to put it together.
I got my work cut out for me, don't I?
Well, it's probably instructive for you to get that information, and I think in the Ohio case that was a few years ago, so hopefully maybe the mindset's changed, but that is good to get that input. If I can, I'm going to move us ahead. Caroline, if you would do us the honors of the final introduction, then we will see what kind of time we have, but hopefully have some more time for questions. And then at the end, I'd like to ask the committee members to stay on the line for just a couple minutes. We want to do a check step in terms of where we are and next steps given our weather situation. So hopefully that works for everyone. Go ahead, Caroline.
Great. Well, I think that was a perfect segue. Well, the next speaker is a perfect segue from Nancy's earlier question on regional collaboratives that bring the data and research expertise typically present in an academic medical center to the broader provider community, which is exactly the sort of effort that our next speaker is going to talk about. And I think also it's a good segue because it is an effort that is funded by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Michigan. So I'd like to welcome Dr. John Furstmeier. He's a graduate of Harvard Medical School and the George D. Zudina Professor of Surgery and Chair of Outcomes Research at the University of Michigan. He is a nationally recognized health services researcher. His previous work has highlighted volume-outcome relationships in surgery and with the Dartmouth Atlas of Healthcare, geographic variations in the use of surgery across the U.S. Today he's going to talk about his work with the Collaborative Quality Improvement Initiative in Michigan. With that, I'd like to turn it over to you, John.
Well, thank you very much. I just want to thank Caroline, Nancy, and Tom for having me, and also for the invitation from the AHA Task Force. Let me see where my slides are. Okay, well, here we go. For those of you that didn't see, the AHA put out a very nice monograph on the phenomenon of geographic variation in healthcare spending. It came out a couple months ago, and it was a very nice explication about the myriad of forces that drive both variation in payment rates as well as service use. It also talked about all of the variety of forces and all the actors that underlie variation. There was one notable exception, however. It talked very little about the role that hospitals have to play in the role of variation in healthcare spending. Now, I'm a surgeon like some of the other panelists, but probably more than them, I have a tendency to oversimplify. So just bear with me. And as I think about it, hospital spending is a simple function of the total number of episodes of hospital-based care times how much spending occurs per episode. Now, you heard a very nice overview by Elliot earlier in this session that talked about a much broader range of issues, but a lot of his work and a lot of the work of Dartmouth Atlas is focused on the number of episodes, how many times people get admitted across hospitals and hospital referral regions, the number of operations that occur. Well, I'm not going to focus there. I'm going to focus on spending per episode. Now, there's a number of drivers of spending per episode that I'm not going to talk about, but also are largely beyond the control of individual leaders at hospitals, and those are both the market forces and the policies that drive our payment rates, the patient populations, and the case mix that underlie the types of services that are delivered at specific hospitals. But where hospitals do have control, and where I'm going to focus my attention, is in the area of the of efficiency of their care, which I'm going to label as a product of two forces, both quality of care as well as practice style. And by practice style, I mean the extent to which we avoid clinical waste. Now, in 2006, almost 1,000 hospitals billed the National Medicare program for at least 50 coronary artery bypass cases. In this slide, I basically showed how total hospital payments per episode vary across those 1,000 hospitals. I've taken price totally out of the mix here. So I've used a single national standardized price for every DRG, and I've taken out things like dish payments and those for graduate medical education. So what you see is totally price standardized. And you can see that in the most efficient fifth of hospitals, the average total payment for a coronary artery bypass graft operation was just below $30,000. For the highest quintile of hospitals, the total average payment per episode was almost $40,000. So where is that difference in $10,000 occurring? Well, this slide gives you a better sense of that. As you can see, about half of that $10,000 difference is occurring for payments associated with the initial stay. And since I've standardized price by the DRG, this is purely occurring because higher-cost hospitals tend to have a distribution of DRGs for that particular service that are the more costly ones, either because of case mix or coding practice or possibly additional complications that so-called bump people up to the higher-paying versions of the DRGs. But notice also that higher-cost hospitals are much more likely to have 30-day readmissions as well as outlier payments, sources of payments that in large part have something to do with adverse outcomes after surgery and very plausibly have a lot to do with quality of care. Now, there's a number of high-level strategies that we could take as a society or payers or policymakers for improving hospital quality. We could follow that set of strategies that I think was outlined nicely by Dr. Korn in his description of the Blue Distinction programs for Blue Cross and Blue Shield, i.e., we could use techniques of selective contracting or centers of excellence programs to try to steer people to high quality and low cost hospitals. The problem with this, of course, is that there's a number of political as well as practical barriers associated with concentrating care. We're also not nearly as good as we think in identifying excellent hospitals. Alternatively, payers and policymakers could use a variety of carrots and sticks to reward hospitals for their compliance with a small number of evidence-based practices of care associated with hospital-based care. Many of you are familiar with the pay-for-performance programs associated with SCIP, both in the public and the private sectors. These programs, I think, can be fairly characterized as having moved the needle in terms of achieving their outcomes on process of care, but there's very little evidence that hospital outcomes have gotten better as a result. And finally, hospitals can participate in any number of a variety of national-level clinical outcomes registries in the hope that their physicians in hospitals will get more relevant feedback about how they're doing. While that certainly can spur local QI activities, in the process, hospitals and their physicians don't learn specifically what they could be doing better. So what I'm going to talk about for the next 15 or 20 minutes is collaborative quality improvement as a strategy for both improving quality as well as reducing cost. Now, this, everybody knows, is motherhood and apple pie. The basic idea is physicians and hospitals collaborate with and learn from each other in improving their outcomes. They are generally based on very highly detailed clinical registries with information on both processes of care and outcomes. Though participants get detailed feedback on their performance relative to their peers, a variety of strategies, both empirical as well as qualitative, are used to identify and implement those practices associated with optimal outcomes. Now, I've learned most of what I know not only from Elliot Fisher, but also from my father-in-law, Dr. Jerry O'Connor, who, as many of you know, is the architect of the Northern New England Cardiovascular Disease Study Group. This was arguably the seminal exercise in regional collaborative QI programs. This program, over a course of 10 or 15 years, demonstrated the power of this strategy to significantly improve outcomes in the field of cardiac surgery and interventional cardiology. The question is, why has this model failed to disseminate, to scale up both in clinical scope as well as across the country? Well, it could be that it's hard. It could be that there's not good measurement platforms or naturally occurring collaborative systems for making this happen. It could be that, you know, that this initial model succeeded only because it occurred in New England, at least in the northern part of New England, where hospitals are separated by 100 miles and usually by big mountain ranges. There's good reason, though, to think that in the right setting, though, this model can be applied much more broadly. So what I'm going to focus on is a unique experiment that's rolling out in the state of Michigan that is just starting to bear fruit and to demonstrate the ability of this model to significantly improve outcomes as well as reduce costs. For those of you that are unfamiliar with this program, this started as a pilot study funded by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Michigan in 1998. It was first applied using a technique that was adopted very closely from the NNE model that focused on interventional cardiology. It then got implemented extremely broadly approximately 4 or 5 years ago. Now, this is a partnership between Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Michigan, approximately 45 or 50 of the largest of Michigan's hospitals, and clinician scientists, mainly but not entirely based at the University of Michigan. In 2009, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Michigan put about $22 million into running these specific programs. For the last 5 years, they've been running a total of 7 programs, and I'm not going to run the list here, but as you can see, they're programs that focus largely on procedures and or other types of inpatient hospital-based care. In 2010, 3 additional programs will be implemented across the state. There's about 50 hospitals that are taking part in these programs, and in excess of 100,000 patients experience one of these diagnoses or undergo one of these interventions and get enrolled into the CEQI programs. Now, before I show you some of the findings, let me just give you a couple of basic facts about how these programs are implemented. Hospitals are paid simply for their participation, completely independent of how they perform, either well or poorly. They get compensated as a percentage of their total revenue from Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Michigan. In 2007, the total payments across the 50 hospitals vary from as low as a total of $10,000 at one hospital. That's very small. Even participated in only one of the programs to in excess of $1 million. For the large majority of hospitals, the payments from Blue Cross and Blue Shield greatly exceed their marginal costs associated with being part of the program. Now, in exchange for payment from Blue Cross and Blue Shield, hospitals and their physician champions are expected to gather and submit relevant data in a timely fashion. They must attend quarterly QI meetings for each one of Boone collaboratives, and they're expected to implement, along with their peers, those QI interventions that are identified and agreed upon at the quarterly meetings. Performance data is known to Boone coordinating centers, but is kept confidential across Boone participating hospitals, and it is kept confidential from the underwriter, Blue Cross in Blue Shield of Michigan. These collaborative programs share some of the underlying goals and overlap heavily with the participating hospitals from the very successful MHA and Keystone project. But I think it differs in a number of key ways. And again, I'm oversimplifying, but the Keystone project with the Michigan Hospital Association is largely about the implementation of checklists and ensuring that hospitals systematically implement those practices for which we have good evidence need to be implemented. While those collaboratives certainly share that goal, they're as much about learning new information and trying to help hospitals get better in ways that aren't explicitly dictated by existing guidelines and evidence. Now, among the largest of the seven Michigan CQI programs is one that focuses on all patients undergoing general and vascular surgery. The MSQC program now enrolls about 45 hospitals, represents about almost 100,000 patients annually, and it tracks its clinical outcome measures based on the American College of Surgeons NFQIP program, which is a very standardized, very widely recognized clinical outcomes registry. Now, as you can see here, this basically shows what's happened over the five-year time period of after implementation of this collaborative. And, of course, you see time on the horizontal. You see on the vertical is the percent of patients experiencing the primary outcome measure associated with the NSQIP measurement system, which is morbidity or just a simple measure of one of serious complications. Now in the red is how Michigan has done over time, and you can see over the five-year period that the complication rate has fallen by about a third. In absolute terms, the complication rate has fallen by 5%. Now, I want you to notice a couple of other things. The first is that the yellow line is basically the national benchmark, and here it is based on the same measurement system, but it's the 160 non-Michigan hospitals that are submitting exactly the same data to the American College of Surgeons NISQIP program. And notice a couple things. Number one, the national benchmark is entirely flat, which means that what's happening in Michigan is not just a result of secular trends. The second thing that I'll just will point out is that the 160 hospitals that are in the NSQIP program are very overrepresented by many of the hospitals whose leaders are taking part in this conference call. They tend to be large, very academic medical centers who, on average, do significantly better than some of their non-academic peers. So Michigan, of course, is all of the 40 or 50 hospitals, of which only a small percentage are those that would, in other circumstances, be identified as centers of excellence. Now, let me show you what's happened in one other area. We run a CQI program that focuses on the field of bariatric surgery. Now, just like the last slide, you see time going across the horizontal, but instead on the vertical axis you see rates of mortality over time. The national benchmark, as determined for the nationwide inpatient sample and a variety of other published studies, would indicate that the national average rate of mortality with bariatric surgery is about 0.22%. Well, you can see that over the year that our collaborative was first launched, that our mortality rate was very comparable to that national benchmark. But as you can see, by year two, and certainly into year three, our mortality rate has plummeted. In 2009, there were 6,300 bariatric operations done in the state of Michigan with only two deaths. Had we experienced the same mortality rate as our national benchmark, there would have been on the order of 14 deaths. That is a remarkable change. And I'll summarize just quickly the findings from the other CQI programs. Cardiac surgery assesses its performance based on the STS Clinical Outcomes Registry, which, of course, is a national program that scores individual hospitals according to a composite measure with 11 different items. Well, it gives every hospital that participates a one-star, two-star, or three-star rating. For the first 2 years of the collaborative, Michigan as a whole got a two-star rating, implying that it was statistically indistinguishable from the national benchmark. For the last 18 months, however, Michigan, if it were treated as a single hospital, would get a three-star rating, which means that as an entire state, it falls within the top 10th percentile of U.S. hospitals. In interventional cardiology, Michigan significantly outperforms national benchmarks from the American College of Cardiology based on its national registry. It's too soon for me to have anything to say about the effectiveness of the CQI programs in breast cancer, in peripheral vascular interventions, and in cardiac CT scanning. Now, how does improvement occur? Well, I believe improvement occurs by a myriad of different factors. Some of it are simply is derivative of the basic act of systematic outcomes measurement, the so-called Hawthorne effect, that spurs learning and reflection by individual doctors, but no doubt incentivizes and helps individual targets, helps individual hospitals target their internal QI activities. But I have no doubt that a large amount of the improvement that's occurred over broad areas of clinical care in the state of Michigan is by a very explicit and systematic program that aims at the dissemination of practices for which there already is good evidence of efficacy. It's using these very detailed, very large clinical outcomes registries to empirically identify those processes of care associated with better outcomes, and the use of non-empirical strategies and benchmarking to understand what it is about those hospitals that leads to their superior outcomes. And finally, most of the CQI programs have a non-punitive program for identifying and helping those hospitals that are at the wrong side of the performance distribution. Now, I know I'm here to talk about hospital spending, so let me back up and spend the last 5 or 10 minutes talking about the relationship between hospital quality and cost and the improvement of and how improvement in quality leads directly to cost. And I believe that Dr. James was quite eloquent on this particular topic a few minutes ago. Well, let's get back to that diagram that I showed you earlier, and I think efficiency, at least in terms of spending per episode, is a function of both quality as well as practice style. Let me focus first on, let me just tell you a quick story that bears on the potential of CQI programs to eliminate wasteful practice styles. This thing is an inferior vena cava filter. It looks like a badminton birdie. It gets inserted through a catheter in the common femoral vein and placed in the inferior vena cava. The basic purpose of this device, which gets inserted in about 200,000 patients every year in the U.S., is basically to keep blood clots from traveling from the major veins of the lower half of the body to the lungs and causing fatal pulmonary embolism. These things are used commonly in a variety of contexts, but including in bariatric surgery. Their dissemination, though, is significantly outpacing evidence about how well they work. Well, we use data from the bariatric CQI program, and first, I'll tell you that most of our CQI programs get linked with the claims databases from Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Michigan. Well, these IVC filters, as simple as they look, they're not nearly as cheap as you would think. The marginal costs associated with placing a filter in the context of bariatric surgery is on the order of $13,000. Well, we were intrigued about how different hospitals were using, were employing this fairly controversial practice. And as you can see here, on the x-axis are the 20 hospitals that in 2007 were in the business of bariatric surgery in the state of Michigan. You see on the vertical the proportion of all of the bariatric surgery patients that were getting an IVC filter. Well, notice that 14 of the hospitals were using these filters very seldomly. In fact, there were 5 hospitals that didn't put them in anybody. But notice that there were 6 hospitals that were putting them in a very high percentage of their patients. In fact, 2 of the 3 busiest hospitals were putting these things in more than a quarter of their patients. So, obviously, with the richness of our clinical outcomes registry, the very first question we ask is, what are we learning about the extent to which patients getting these IVC filters have safer surgery? Well, we were surprised to learn to find just the contrary, that adjusting with very detailed data for patient case mix and all factors associated with perioperative risk with bariatric surgery, we found that patients getting filters had higher rates of postoperative venous thromboembolism. They had higher rates of all types of serious complications. But most compellingly, they had more than double the rate of death and permanent disability. This was a statistically significant finding. We looked more carefully at this and found out that over half of all the deaths occurring in bariatric surgery patients that were getting a filter were occurring as a direct consequence of the filter itself. Because patients were getting blood clots upstream of the filter was causing the vena cava to clot off with attendant shock. The filter was migrating up to the heart with all of the attendant problems associated with such. So what did we do? Well, in February of 2008, I did nothing other than give a 15-minute PowerPoint presentation to 50 of the surgeons in the state of Michigan. And as you can see, over a period of about 9 or 12 months, rates of IVC filter placement in Michigan dropped from almost 8% to less than 4%. We looked more carefully at the data at that time. We saw that there were 2 hospitals that clearly didn't get the memo. I called those surgeons on the phone. I made sure that they understood the data, and within a period of 1 or 2 quarters, our rates had fallen to less than 2%. The net savings associated with just this simple serendipitous finding and practice changing for Michigan payers is about $3 million a year. Note that the total cost of the bariatric CQI program is $1.5 million a year. So just this one change more than paid for the cost of the whole program. Now, let me close by just making a couple of financial observations on the quality side. Now, in the context of discussing the return on investment associated with the Michigan CQI programs, I'm going to give you some back-of-the-envelope ROI calculations from the perspective of payers. I will do the same for hospitals, both under the status quo, but also under the eventuality of episode-based bundle payments. But before I give you these calculations, let me first point out what is obvious to some but not to all, and that is that adverse outcomes are very costly. This is a slide showing some very seminal work by my colleague, Dr. Justin Dimmick, who very painstakingly used a resource-based cost accounting system to assess the true cost associated with different types of complications as categorized within the NFQ IP program. And you notice that the true cost of complications is a function, of course, of what type of complication. But if you look on the left-hand side, you see that the true additional cost associated with the complication is about $10,000. Notice also that payers pick up about 75% of this additional cost associated with complications. Well, Dimmick and others did a follow-up study that looked at this from the perspective of hospitals. And here, this shows the effect of a complication on the margins associated with different types of inpatient surgery, at least at the University of Michigan. And I hope that Doug Strong is listening carefully here. You notice here that the average margin associated with the portfolio of different types of general and vascular surgery operations that are profiled within NSQIP, among those patients with no complication, the margin was $3,288. The margin associated with patients with a complication was still positive, but significantly smaller. The net difference in the operating margin associated with patients without and with a complication was about $2,500. So those data, of course, are relevant to some of the calculations I'm going to show you now. Let's first look at the ROI associated with the CQI programs from the perspective of Michigan payers. Now, let's focus just only on one of the seven CQI programs. I'll focus on MSQC, which, as you recall, is targeting just general and vascular surgery. I focus on that one because it's easy and because it's the biggest. Well, if you buy what I told you several slides ago, that the result of the Michigan CQI program was an absolute drop in rates of complication by 5%, what this means is that 5,000 fewer Michigan patients are experiencing a surgical complication every year in Michigan. Now, from the slide I just showed you, the payer share of that additional cost of complications is $7,500 per individual patient. So the annual savings for Michigan payers is $37.5 million. Now, keep in mind the total payment, the total cost for Blue Cross and Blue Shield for all of these programs is $22 million. The cost associated with just this one CQI program is $5 million. The ROI is about 7 associated with this program. Now, let's look at it from the perspective of hospitals. And here, let's imagine that we're out of Michigan and payers are not underwriting the cost associated with participation in the CQI program. And let me show you a graphic that looks just like what I just showed you, but just imagine that we're focusing on one hospital, and I picked just a, you know, what's the average sized hospital in the state of Michigan. The average sized hospital in the state of Michigan does an average of 2,000 general and vascular operations that would typically be profiled by the NSQ IP program. A reduction in complication rates by 5% means that 100 patients each year don't get complications that they otherwise would have. If the net impact on the margins associated with these patients is $2,500, the average savings to that hospital in any given year is $250,000. The average cost associated with participation in the NSQIP is about $150,000. So the ROI in this scenario is about 1.6. And finally, let's imagine that we did the same exact calculations, but this time we're in a mode where hospitals are bearing all of the risk associated with their complications under some version of episode-based bundle payments. Well, here, the math looks just the same, but instead of $2,500, the net financial impact for each complication to the hospital is about $10,000. The annual savings is $1 million each year. The ROI is about 6. So here is my last slide. So I hope you appreciate that the problem of a variation in healthcare spending across regions or across hospitals is very complicated. By now, I focused on only one very narrow piece of that, which is variation in cost per episode. But I believe this is a important piece of the broader problem of variation in hospital spending. But I think it's particularly relevant to this audience because it is directly actionable by hospitals by better managing both their quality as well as their practice style. the 4 or 5 year history of the expanded Michigan CQI programs gives me good reason to believe that these things are good for patients. They're good for the physicians to the extent that they avoid some of the implications of centers of excellence and pay-for-performance programs on professional autonomy and professionalism. And these CQI programs have a very strong ROI for both hospitals as well as for payers and ultimately for our society. Thank you very much for your time, and I look forward to any of your questions.
Well, thank you, Doctor, very much, and I guess I would open it up for questions.
Thank you very much. Again, the floor is open for questions. Please press star 1 now to ask a question or make a comment. Our first question comes from Greg Becker.
Thank you very much, Doctor. I appreciate it, and I apologize for the croaky voice here, but I am fighting off a bad cold myself here. We've had a similar program here in Tennessee working with Peter Pronovost and Johns Hopkins, and also have the Enskia program going as well. And I have to tell you, we pretty much have seen exactly the same kind of outcomes that you have seen, or that they've seen in Michigan in particular, in terms of the decrease in number of surgical infections. I guess the comment and maybe question that I have is that it seems to me that as a national strategy, one of the things that we really should be focusing on is trying to convince our members, which I know we've started the process here, that quality makes good business sense, that we can save some dollars, and I think that you'll see that these kind of things do make that case. The only problem, obviously, we have the variation on that is that you also lose dollars on the other side. But on the whole, I think we've seen, particularly in Tennessee, some significant savings.
Thanks, Greg.
Well, thank you very much for that comment, and I couldn't agree with you more. I think that your comments also bear on the question of how do we scale this up nationally. And, of course, the simple answer to that is we need to better publicize or disseminate the business case for quality. But I think that as that's happening, I think that there's also a significant role for payers to partner with hospitals to accelerate that appreciation. The program in Michigan started, or was significantly fast-tracked, not because Michigan hospitals are more altruistic or are more trusting of their competitors, or because they had insights about the association between cost and quality more than any of their peers outside of Michigan. What happened was that Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Michigan was particularly visionary, and Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Michigan not only had the insight, but it also had the luxury of, having a very dominant share of the private payer market within the state of Michigan. So we had the incentive, to make this program work to the extent that the benefits would accrue disproportionately to its beneficiaries. But having payers partner with us has been completely instrumental because, number one, they were able to financially incentivize hospitals to take part in this, partly by the implicit threat that not being part of these programs would leave them off the list of the Blue Distinction programs or their other COE programs that you heard Dr. Korn talking about earlier, but also by structuring the rewards, or by structuring the supplemental payments in a way that the rewards associated with participation far outstrip the cost. There was a strong practical case for big hospitals to be part of this. And finally, payers were instrumental to the extent that they established a neutral meeting ground for hospitals. Even if we have the resources, if, for example, some well-intentioned academics from the University of Michigan had tried to make this work, it would have been much slower to get off the ground because of the suspicion that might have occurred by something that was being brokered purely by hospitals. The fact that the payers were taking the lead really took that off the table.
Do we have other questions?
At this time, I'm showing no more questions.
Caroline, Nancy, comments?
Well, why don't you open it up for broader questions for any of the panelists that still are on the line?
Okay, that's a good idea. So I guess I'm not sure who is still on the line, but I'd say any question anyone has, let's open it up and see what's on people's minds.
If you would like to ask a question to any of the remaining speakers, which include John Burkmeyer, Elliot Fisher, Thomas Rosenthal, please press star one now. Our first question comes from Doug Strong.
Hi, Doug Strong from the University of Michigan, a great set of speakers. So one can think about variation at many different levels. I think we, at least I started by thinking about geographic variation, region to region. We've also been led to think about variation within the region, different provider systems in a region, hospitals and doctors, and also variation just within a provider system itself, as some of the speakers have identified today. So it seems like there's a lot of richness in where to turn in terms of where to make improvement, what's most viable and how can it be done most quickly. And I wonder if there are any comments about which of those three levels would bear the most fruit.
Well, this is Dahlia Fisher. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah, we can hear you.
Great. I mean, I think there are tremendous gains from the hospital kinds of analyses that John has done, the individual physician level comparisons that Brent James has done. And I think at the policy level, there's powerful leverage that comes from continuing to understand and get communities to think about per capita costs, you know, at that level as well. So I think, you know, we don't have the luxury, as Alan Horn pointed out, to wait another 10 years to make progress here. There are efforts that can be made at the community level, drawing on both, you know, under 65 and over 65 per capita spending. The data is very clear that utilization rates for the under and over 65 correlate very closely. And getting providers together to talk about how they're going to manage the growth of the hospital sector in their communities, which is the major driver of, you know, a medical arms race is the major driver of healthcare costs as we look across regions. We're still shy of better empirical data, but the anecdotes are and the data from on for-profit hospital ownership and for-profit hospital conversion in communities showing rapid that contributing to growth in spending. It's compelling enough that there's important opportunities at the regional level. I think there's tremendous, you know, the work that John Burkmeyer and, you know, his father-in-law done is tremendous in terms of getting providers to feel they're to take advantage of the opportunities they have to improve. And, you know, what the data I showed from Health Partners or that Brent showed from partners in Boston or that Brent showed from Intermountain Healthcare says that within a given system, looking at variation in individual physicians' practices is also high leverage. So I would say go for all three.
Okay. Again, to ask a question, please press star one now.
If I may, this is Scott. I have one for Dr. Fisher. Accepting a kind of a reduction in risk-taking, at least theoretically, what do you think, how would you describe the key differences between an ACO and an HMO? Does it really make any substantive difference, or is it just kind of a pig by a different name?
Who's listening?
Yeah.
I think there are real differences. When we first undertook capitation in the early 90s, the vision was the fully integrated delivery systems like Kaiser. The practice was relatively small physician, often small physician groups, capitated with no acknowledgement of the challenges of risk bearing by physicians, with no risk adjustment, and with no performance measurement. The advances that we're trying to introduce here are to be very careful about the distinction between bearing clinical risk and financial risk, to be thoughtful about actuarial models that will allow even relatively non-integrated groups, for instance, the group around Tucson Medical Center, one of our pilots, are completely independent physicians. So it's create actuarial models that work, be thoughtful about risk adjustment, and then most importantly, really ensure that we use performance measurement to reassure the public that they're not getting burned under the old, managed care version 1.0. So in a sense, it's trying to get managed the last time, get it right this time. And we're very vulnerable. There's no question that to have this succeed, it has to have a pathway for non-integrated physician groups to come together and be supported and make progress and be rewarded for improving quality and lowering costs. But it also has to have the public and consumer groups being very comfortable that this isn't just another opportunity for providers to stint on care. Right. There really will be improvement.
Thank you. Other questions?
I'm not sure that's an adequate answer, but it's the answer that's the best answer we have.
That actually makes good sense. I really do think the performance measures alone is probably a giant step in the right direction.
We're carefully laying out, collaborating with consumer groups, NQF, NCQA, a pathway toward really high-level performance measures that will both support good quality improvement work, the kind of work that John has done, but equally importantly, just as importantly, reassure the public that they're not getting lousy care.
Great.
Scott, it's Nancy. If I could ask a question, following up on the point that Tom Rosenthal made about the importance of health service researchers interacting with the medical leaders, the medical staff leaders, in order to make change happen in their organizations, I wanted to ask John Berkmeyer, is that part of the secret sauce in Michigan as well for the projects that you've been working on? And if so, could you say a little bit more about it than that? Because you referenced the benchmark from the NISQIP project, and certainly your hospitals have been able to achieve, based on the data you showed us, more significant improvement than some of the NISQIP hospitals have been able to achieve. So, where I know they've got good data feedback to those hospitals, what's the difference in Michigan?
Well, I'm not sure that Michigan is unique from a number of perspective with regards to many of its academic medical center peers, but I will say two things. The first is that relative to other university-based health systems, there is no firewall between the academic health services research sector and the clinical leadership of the hospital. Many of the physician leaders of these CQI programs, to which I described, not only are accomplished researchers, but they have very senior leadership roles within the University of Michigan Health System. So, insights that occur from the research side get applied immediately into clinical care. The insights that come from senior clinical leaders help inform some of the analyses that ultimately drive the underlying research. The other question you raised is why are Boone Collaborative so much more successful than a much simpler and much cheaper model of simply tracking your outcomes and providing feedback to participating hospitals. And I think it's that the Hawthorne effect, as it's frequently termed, is important, but it is insufficient. And again, I think that there's a number of things that individual hospitals can do on their own. They can, as Brent has suggested, look for ways to reduce unwanted variation. They can participate in the NSQIP or other benchmarking programs to at least get a starting point for where they should be focusing their efforts. They could do what Keystone and what the programs in Tennessee are they're doing to make sure that they implement either checklists or other rigorous approaches to make sure that we're all doing the things that we know we should be doing. But again, that's as far as individual hospitals can go for them really to get to the next level. And I honestly feel that that Michigan hospitals have gotten to the next level. They have to learn from each other, and they have to learn from each other in ways that they can't just by reading the most recent clinical trials or the most recent best evidence. And there's a number of things that, you know, are outside of the domain of published science that you learn only by talking to each other. You know, our practices vary so widely that it's amazing, you know, how many natural experiments are underway that ultimately help us learn about the association between individual practices and the central outcomes for hospital-based care. And I can tell you quite honestly that in my role in Michigan, that I've clinically learned a lot more from my community surgeon peers than they've learned from me, at least on the clinical side. And that's the type of learning that doesn't happen unless you are working with others.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Judith Rich.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I just really wanted to echo what Elliot said here at Tucson Medical Center about the difference between the HMO and the Accountable Care Organization, and to really emphasize the fact that there is a lot of risk here. And if we didn't believe that there was enough evidence to support what we're doing, it would be a risk not worth taking, but I believe it is in our pilot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope we can help you succeed.
I'm counting on it, Elliot.
I'm sure you are.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Dr. Pardes.
Well, first of all, I want to echo what other people have said regarding the quality of speakers and the program. Seems to me one of the things that have come out of this is a substantial broadening of the conversation. And if you start from the oversimplified notion that stimulated a lot of this, which is there are high-cost Medicare institutions, low-cost, and that means good and bad, and what we should do is take them to good and bad and give them to the good, and we'll fix everything, has become a much more complicated, it starts to get more real conversation. And I think Alan Korn's notion of, at the end of the day, waiting for whatever's going to happen on health reform, we should be pushing to how to make quality better. But a couple questions I would have is, can one imagine studies in which you try to take, be it cost quality or some combination thereof, and look at the range of factors that contribute and try to figure out how to quantify the various variance or contribution of each of those factors? Is there some way one could get a composite look at some aspect of this? And the second question I would have, and maybe somebody from AHA could speak to this, I know it might be just attestation for the moment, but would it be interesting to find out among the range of possible ways hospitals can really improve quality and safety, what they're doing? The comment that Alan Korn made intrigues me, because many of us who seem to feel we're doing a lot in our own hospitals, when they hear there's God knows how many who are not, I'd like to know more about that. And for starters, at least hear what people think they're doing and get some sense of how much the movement towards safety and quality really is.
This is Caroline Steinberg. Can you hear me?
Yes.
We can hear you, Caroline.
Okay, good. I wasn't sure whether I was still muted. Let me just address the first question. I think Nancy would probably be better to address the second question, which was on the, the factors affecting variation. We are currently in the process, and actually would have in our second day of meetings, talked about a regression analysis that we're doing to really parse out some of the various factors that have been mentioned by the task force members in our first meeting, such as the demographic factors, the health status factors, the various things that we can tell about the market, the supply of physicians, the quality indicators, measures of access, and we are beginning to parse it out, and I think at the end of the day what we're finding out is that, you know, health status matters a lot, and that there are pretty big differences in health status across different parts of the country, and that that health status is probably, you know, being influenced by differences in poverty levels. And then we've also parsed out the, you know, the wage adjustments, and I think we can agree there that they are important, more important in some regions than others, but they're still a fairly small piece of the pie. But then, you know, at the end of the day, there's still a really large chunk that is simply unexplained. And there may be other factors that we can't account for that can explain it, but I think a lot of that, more than half, is still relates to variations in the practice of medicine across the country.
And Caroline, it's Nancy. I'll augment your answer with the response to Herb's second question, which is we did do a survey. Actually, it was done by the folks working on our Hospitals in Pursuit of Excellence activity, one of our quick surveys to try and learn what it is that people are involved in. It was not a sufficiently robust response that we're going to ever publish that data, but I'm sure we'd be able to share the results with this group, this task force, to inform their deliberations, because there were some fairly interesting answers, even though the response rate was not large enough for us to publish it. So, and off the top of my head, my recollection is that there was a lot of different kinds of activity, a lot of folks participating in some of the big broad brush quality improvement activities that have been discussed on the phone, the Surgical Care Improvement Project, the IHI campaigns, those sorts of things, the implementation of checklists and other ways to reduce surgical complications and central line bloodstream infections. So lots of activity was reported, and we'll be sure to get that set of slides for you and share it with you at our next meeting.
I don't know if you can go on and get some anonymized data with regard to changes in errors, infections, falls, ulcers, et cetera.
We could try. We could try.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Rob Verar.
Hi. Can everyone hear me?
We can hear you, Rob.
Hey, good. Scott, I just want to really just again echo what you said, what everyone said about the quality of the program. It's been fantastic. And really, the more I learn, I guess the less I know about this topic. It keeps expanding for me. My question and comment is, here I've got the luxury of dealing with payers, particularly the private payers at our company here at Community Health Systems from coast to coast, and I see a huge variation in what they're trying to do with a lot of the quality programs that you've experienced in Michigan. And I guess the question is, how? And really to echo again what Herb said, how do you boil all of it down, and how do you, I mean, it looks like it works very good for a large population, you know, with one payer in particular. How do you break that down to community hospitals that maybe have numerous payers with smaller volumes and every single one trying a different program? And as you said, I think, Dr. Birkmeyer, about it has to be a data-rich environment. Everyone's clamoring for a different set of data, and you're gathering that. Yeah, I guess, how do we as a group here kind of distill all of that and make proposals that make sense across from top to bottom, you know, across all of these different strata?
Thank you for your comment in your question, and I'm not sure I have a great answer for you, but what I will say is that on the one hand, we were blessed in Michigan by not only having financial underwriting from a dominant private payer, but we also had, you know, had a couple of major academic centers with a lot of talented people that could make this happen. But that doesn't mean that I think it's unrealistic for similar models to be implemented elsewhere. I would point out that of the 50 or so Michigan hospitals that are part of the programs that I described, the large majority of them are community hospitals that, you know, that would be characterized by many as, you know, as poorly organized and having, you know, significant, you know, in having physician staffs that are not well integrated with the hospital. And I think that we have potentially most to offer those types of places. The model where every hospital does its own thing with its own measure is just entirely wasteful, and I don't think gets us to where we need to be. And I think that what we need to do is look for ways to, you know, to implement a model that is analogous to what I described, but perhaps look for opportunities to make it cheaper and to make it scalable, you know, in settings where there's not a single dominant private payer. I think that we can make it cheaper by, you know, by being strategic and not gathering more data than we need. We gather probably way more data than we need in Michigan just because we can.
Right.
Over time, we'll make much better use of electronic medical information, particularly as more hospitals start sharing a similar platform. That'll make this program much, much cheaper. Of the $22 million a year that goes into our program, probably two-thirds of that is for the simple act of gathering data, and I suspect those costs are going to fall over time. But then finally, even though Michigan is not the only state that is dominated by a single private payer, we need to look for models that that are applicable in areas where the market share is much more fractured. And I also think we need to find to make sure that public sector payers, you know, see the value in this sort of a strategy. Underwriting this sort of program might cost CMS a lot more than it currently puts into SCIP and its other pay-for-performance programs, but I posit that they would get much more value out of them. In the private sector, we need to find ways to, get the payers for once to collaborate in the same way that we're exhorting the hospitals to do so.
Agree. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Tom Prislack.
Hi, thanks very much. I just add my congratulations to everyone, too. Very well done. A couple just real quick comments. One, Herb's question about the dissemination of the information. This may be a comment more for Caroline or Rich if he's still on the line, but AHA is undertaking an effort known as Hospitals in Pursuit of Excellence, and the short comment would be, much of what's been discussed today is really, I think, grist for that mill and the things that can come out of it. So I think this has been productive in that regard as well. Second, on the ACO issue and the pilots that are out there, two points. One is I really hope that you all will be able to shed light on the risk question and adequately accounting for the risk, because having lived through capitation here in California, where arguably, capitation theoretically has certain elements of it that should have been less risky compared to the ACO model, I think there's a lot of concern by people who have been through capitation that ACOs have greater risk, and so you pilot folks can do us all a great service by showing how to beat that. The other point on ACOs that I'd mentioned maybe for the AHA staff is for these things to be done in a lot of communities around the country without a lot of other corporate consolidation taking place would require some legal barriers being removed. So we might want to add that to the list of things to be addressed in order to expedite the kind of things that we're talking about being achieved. Thanks.
This is Elliot. I'd love to. Tom, thanks for the comments. We're, in addition to working with the pilot sites, we have a pretty large technical work group that includes folks from CMS and some actuaries that really is trying to move forward on the how do you do this effectively. And I think, and on the legal issues as well, we're working, McClellan and I and the others, to try to identify the legal and technical barriers that need to be overcome and work with the pilot sites to help them figure out how to get the legal cross the I's and dot the T's, but also to gather some information that would be helpful to both CMS and to Congress and to the FTC on changes that would clarify the legal risks and make it, you know, make a clear pathway toward the kind of accountability and clinical integration that we need less legally risky.
This is Linda Fishman from the AHA staff. I'd like to echo what Dr. Fisher just said. We have a trend watch forthcoming on clinical integration, which is about to be sent to the printer. It is a pretty complete explanation of the kinds of legal barriers that exist to forming new delivery systems, including accountable care organizations, and I'd be happy to share a copy of that with you and your technical group, Dr. Fisher, as well as disseminate it to the broader membership. In addition, we're in the process of trying to disseminate our Payment Reform Task Force final product, which deals with many of these issues and describes pathways that hospitals might take to adopt new delivery system reforms, such as ACOs and bundled payments, and even a strategy for rural hospitals, which, you know, are in a completely different place on a lot of these issues.
I'm showing no more questions at this time. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star one now.
Well, I think it's taking the chair's prerogative here. Everyone has been most gracious with their time. I think it might be a good time to call this session to an end. And in doing that, I want to make a couple of groups of thank yous to Elliot Fisher, to Brent James, Dr. Rosenthal, Dr. Korn, Dr. Birkmeyer. Can't tell you how much we appreciate you taking your time to spend it with us. I think someone said it for me when you comment about how deep and how complex this is and how much command you all have of the subject. It was impressive, to say the least, and it's given us an awful lot to think about. I also want to just take a minute and recognize Caroline, Nancy, and Linda. As you might imagine, 3 days ago we were all planning on being in Chicago together, and here we are now sitting in our various locations around the country, and they all made it happen very seamlessly. And to them, I'd like to say a giant thank you, because I think there's a lot of reasons to believe this might not have happened as well as it did, so thank you. If I could, I'd like to invite committee members to hang on the line for just a minute, invite everyone else to feel free to sign off, and committee members, we won't hope to take too much of your time, but we do have one question to ask you, and then we'll get everybody out of here. So again, everybody, thank you very, very much.
Welcome. Great to be with you all. Take care.